Today's episode of Ariel Helwani's MMA show contains explicit language that may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Ariel Helwani's MMA show!
Back in your life on this Monday, July 29, 2019. Hello again, everyone. I'm Ariel Helwani. How are you? Good to be back. Good to slowly get my voice back as well. Pretty much since the moment I said goodbye last week on this show, up until now, I've been struggling to get it back, as you may have heard throughout our coverage in Edmonton. But I feel pretty good right now, so it's good to be back doing the show. It's good to be back from Edmonton. Edmonton was really fun. As I've said on numerous occasions, the best arena in North America is Rogers Place. And so it's always nice to go back home. It's always nice to be in the Great White North. And it's always nice to be at Rogers Place. I appreciate them reaching out to me, sliding into my DMs, and letting me know that they were thankful for all the nice things that I've been saying about the arena. So that was nice. And of course, it was nice to be back covering another Max Holloway fight. I feel like that was just what the doctor ordered for all of us in combat sports, at least all of us who are MMA fans, but also boxing fans, because last week was a tough one if you're a combat sports fan. Seeing two boxers die as a result of injuries suffered in recent matches, and then all of a sudden you're just, you know, asked to kind of ignore it all and move on and cover cage fighting. And I would be lying if I didn't say that, you know, you feel a little funny about it all. And yeah, we've been accustomed to sort of be immune to all of that and to just be numb to all the violence in combat sports. But when you see people die, young people die as a result of injuries sustained in a fight, it's hard to just move on. And so then you go to Edmonton and you see Max Holloway and you see the way he acts in front of everyone. You see the way he is with his son, and you see the way Frankie Edgar acts in front of everyone, and you see the way he is with his kids, and you see the way they act between each other and bring up their sons on the weigh-in stage and all that stuff. And you just can't help but feel good about fighting for just a little bit and about the people involved in this sport. Max, I mean, is just on some kind of roll these days. I mean, look at this post right over here that he put on his Instagram. Who writes things like this afterwards? Who talks like this? Who gives props like this? Very few people in the fight game. There was that moment right after he won. Of course, he won via decision. It was a fairly one-sided fight. He was never in danger. I thought he won all five rounds, but there was a moment right after the fight where Joe Rogan is walking up to him to do the customary post-fight interview, and Max says to Rogan quietly, "No, talk to Frankie first." And Rogan says, "I'll talk to him, but I'm going to talk to you first." Like, who does that? Who acts like that? Max Holloway acts like that. He is such a great representative of our sport. And it's a shame that he can't fight in Hawaii, but who other than Max would then adopt a country that is that far away from Hawaii and just call it his own? And like, they really do love him in Canada. This isn't a gimmick. Here's a guy who's been sort of dealt a bad card, you know, a bad hand, excuse me, you know, can't fight in Hawaii. They can't make it happen. He's like, all right, they keep putting me in Canada for some reason. I'm just going to call these people my own. 10th Island. Isn't it great? And they love him there. It's amazing to watch. It really feels like he's an honorary Canadian. And so once again, he shows up. Once again, he wins. He reminds everyone that he's the king of the featherweights. Yeah, he stumbled at 155 against Poirier, but he's still the man at 145. He gets the new belt. And now the big question is, does he fight on October 5th? UFC 243 against Alex Volkanovski. That's the fight that makes all the sense in the world. It would be a nice co-main for Whitaker Adesanya. Can they get it done? I think it's a little too soon. That's 2+ months. That's a very quick turnaround for a guy who just went five rounds Saturday, went five rounds in April, and then had the fight that he had against Brian Ortega back in December. That would be, what, four fights in the span of 10 or so months? That's a lot to ask. Now, I think December 14th in the 9th Island, Las Vegas, would make a lot more sense, but I know they're going to try to push. I know they're going to try to make it happen. Thus far, those conversations haven't happened just yet, I'm told, but they're going to try to make it happen. Credit to Volkanovski, traveled 37 hours just to weigh in, just to get paid, just to be the standby fighter. In the end, they didn't need it, but I thought it was great that he was there. Clearly, he's next, so there's no speculation needed, no drama needed. We know he's next, but the date, Can they get him? Can they get Max to agree to October 5th? We shall see. So we'll talk a little bit about that throughout the show. We'll also talk about Chris Cyborg, who won in the co-main event against Felicia Spencer. What a great performance. I was inspired watching that fight, inspired by both women. Felicia Spencer, 7-0 going into that fight. No one thought she can hang with Cyborg like that. No one thought she could take a punch from Cyborg like that. No one thought that she could go toe-to-toe with Cyborg and cut up Cyborg like that early on with those lead Superman elbows, or I should say Superwoman elbows. She was incredible. She was remarkable. And I had a feeling, like, initially I thought, all right, maybe she's biting off a little more than she can chew. Maybe it's too soon for Felicia Spencer. But at the media day on Thursday, when they went toe to toe, face to face, she walked up there with her hands on her hip and said, "What? I'm here. Come get some. Yeah, I look, you know, I'm nice, I'm soft-spoken, I'm sweet. No, I'm not afraid of you, Chris Cyborg." And she walked in there and she gave it her all. Now, you look at the scorecards, 30-27, you say, okay, it wasn't really close. This is one of those times where the scorecards do not tell the story. It's also one of those times where I feel like both fighters' stock went up afterwards. Spencer earned everyone's respect. The fans loved her. The Canadian, she got a nice ovation. Everyone's happy with her performance. She's a reason to keep the 145-pound division around. And then you have Chris Cyborg coming off her first knockout loss, her first loss in 13 years, coming into this fight with so much pressure on her shoulders. She's fighting not only to get back on track, but she's fighting to get all the leverage back, all the momentum back. That was the last fight on her deal. And now we wait and see if she is going to resign. And of course, you would think after a performance like that, that, you know, the feelings would be good. There she is walking around. Cyborg Nunes 2 coming January 2020. That seems to be a sign that she wants the rematch. But yet the narrative once again from Dana White and the brass is that she doesn't want the rematch, is that she doesn't want tough fights, that she doesn't want to stick around. What? What is this? When are we going to start promoting Chris Cyborg the right way? One of the greatest female fighters of all time. An absolute beast in the cage and a sweetheart out of the cage, doing charitable work in Uganda, going to visit children's hospitals in Brazil. This is the kind of person you want on your roster. Someone who messed up back in 2011 and has never messed up since. Come on. What is going on? What's the problem here? At some point, these two sides need to sit down, figure it out, or let's just move on. Because she is going to be the most coveted free agent since Dan Henderson back in the day. Since around 9 or so years ago when Dan Henderson left the UFC, PFL, ONE Championship, Bellator, Ryzen, they're all coming after her. They're all coming after her. So let's figure this out. Let's try to make the rematch happen. How many more times does she have to say that she wants the rematch? When you say she doesn't want the rematch, you're failing to say that she didn't want to sign the deal that you were attaching to the rematch. They're not just going to give a one-fight deal. We know that. Champions clause, extension, they're not going to do that. They're not going to put someone in there against a champion and then just say, okay, you win, you can walk away with the belt. Come on. We're smarter than that. Figure it out. Pay her what she's worth, and let's figure this out. Let's move on. Enough. Look, I'm all for the drama. I'm all for Dana versus Askren and promoter versus, I love that stuff. But in this case, it's uncomfortable at this point. How many more times does she have to tell us that she wants the rematch, that she wants these big fights? Enough already. Let's figure it out or let's move on. Tired of it. All right, here's today's lineup. We'll talk plenty about 240. And of course, Colby Covington is back this Saturday afternoon, by the way, in Newark. That should be very interesting. At around 4 o'clock, Robert Whittaker will be on the program, the reigning defending UFC middleweight champion. It was announced last week. UFC 243 is happening in Melbourne, Australia. And you notice I say Melbourne, not Melbourne, not Melbourne. It's Melbourne. That's what I'm told from the locals. That's what they tell me. Marvel Stadium, formerly known as Etihad Stadium. It is going down. Whittaker will join us. Lou DiBella is one of the all-time best boxing promoters. He's a very smart guy, heartfelt individual. He was talking a lot about what happened in boxing last week. I want to get his thoughts on all of that, see what can be done, see how the community is feeling. I love talking to Lou. Great guy. I'm looking forward to it. Chris Cyborg will join us at around 3:15. We'll get her thoughts on the victory, what's next for her, and how she feels after not only the fight, but the post-fight drama, aftermath, whatever you want to call it. Freddie Prinze Jr., the legend, the Hollywood star himself. Last week we had Steve-O, now we have Freddie Prinze. And I see all you people online, "Ooh, why do you have Freddie Prinze on? Ooh, what are you going to talk about, Scooby-Doo?" No, there's a reason. Have I ever let you down? Isn't there always a reason? There's a reason. All right. So just trust me, for God's sakes. 10 years. When are you going to trust me? This will be great. I am looking forward to it. We're going to talk to Nick Lentz at around 2:25. He's fighting BJ Penn. Yes, BJ is back after they told us that he wouldn't be back, after they said he's done, after they said they can't do this anymore. He's back. Why? I don't know. I'm numb to that as well. I don't get it, but he's back and he's fighting Nick Lentz, and we'll figure it all out with Nick Lentz at 2:25. Jillian Robertson, Canada's own, was victorious against Sarah Frada on Saturday. Good up-and-coming fighter. Great win for her. 125, rising star, potential contender. We'll talk to her at around 2:05. Hakeem Dawoodu will join us at around 1:45. Talk about his big win over the quote-unquote rising star, Yoshinori Horie. Got a big win, and he never smiles. He's always mean. Why? It's very un-Canadian of him. We'll talk to him about that at 1:45. And Jeff Neal had a massive win over Nico Price on Saturday. We'll talk to him about that at 1:25. But first, one of the great stories on Saturday happened in the first fight of the night. Eric Koch returned to action, picked up his first win in 3 years in a brand new weight class. Yes, the former 145er is now fighting at 170. Let's talk to him about that first up on the program. Joining us via Skype right now is Eric Koch. Eric, how are you?
Yo, how's it going, Ariel?
It's going great. I appreciate you doing this, and congratulations on the victory. Wow, your first win in 546 days. What did it feel like to finally get your hand raised again?
Felt so good. So good, man. Just plagued with injuries and having so much time off, for especially to move up a weight class. It felt great to just get my hand raised.
Why did you come back as a 170 pounder?
Oh man, I'll tell you, I've been in this game for so long, and I've cut so much weight. You know, turning 30, it's one of those things, man. I feel like ever since I turned 25, cutting weight has just been a lot harder. And I just thought, you know, 170, naturally I'm walking around about 185, 190. I just think it's stupid. I think it's really dumb to cut so much weight to 55. Kill myself to then fight another human being the next day. I don't think it makes any sense. So, it was just a judgment call, that I had to make. My father, I lost him about a year ago. He was always big on me, you know, not cutting weight, not trying to kill myself, to get to the weights to compete at. And, you know, he passed, and I figured after his passing, I think it was time. It was time for me to move up. I know he'd want me to do it, and, you know, I succeeded. So, proof's in the pudding.
I know you were fighting last week with a heavy heart because of your dad, and I see on social media you honoring him, and I think it was around a year ago that he passed. I know how close you were just from the things that you've written about him and the hashtags and whatnot. Could you tell us, how did he pass away?
It was completely unexpected. It was... I'll never forget. I was still in Milwaukee. I think it was 6 a.m. and my mom called me, and my mom never calls me. My dad was the guy that, you know, I talked to him every single day. My mom, you know, I love her to death, but she's, you know, very independent. She never called me. I had a bad feeling. She called me at 6 a.m. and, pretty much what happened was he had a widowmaker. It was just, rare heart attack that happened in his sleep. You know, thank God he didn't suffer. I think he passed pretty quickly. But you know, we didn't expect it because he was super healthy, took care of his health, exercised all the time. It was just a freak thing that happened. So it was just very unexpected.
You guys were very close.
Very close, man. I said it in my post-fight speech. I don't think a lot of people understood it, but a lot of people, for whatever reason, they think the tattoo on my left chest is Bruce Buffer. That's my dad. I got my tattoo of my dad probably 4 or 5 years ago now. And, you know, he's my biggest supporter, my biggest fan. You know, I didn't graduate high school. I stopped high school to do this. You know, I was so passionate about this, and obviously every single parent out there is not going to, you know, be thrilled when their kid drops out of high school to pursue fighting. And, you know, it was a rocky road, but my dad had my back the entire way. And, I could safely say that my UFC journey wouldn't even have began if not for my father. So, you know, he was my rock, and that's why this fight was for him, man. It's not even, you know, I just feel good to win the fight for him, and not even for myself. It's all for my dad.
What was it like to go through the fight week, but then after get the victory and you can't share that with him? How did it, like, the emotions afterwards, what were those like? I'm sure you were probably really happy to finally get that win, first time in 3 years, but you couldn't share it with your biggest fan.
Yeah, you know, it was a bummer. It was a bummer, but I'll tell you, I'm not religious. I'm very, you know, since my dad passed, I'm very spiritual, though. The whole week went right, man. It felt smooth. It felt right. You know, I had my brother there with me, our good buddy, Brent Stepanek, who was there the day my dad passed. It just felt right. The entire week went really smooth. And, you know, after the fight, was done, before my interview, that's what I did. You know, I dropped down in the middle of the cage. I took a second, put my head down, put my hand on my dad's, face on my tattoo. And I just, you know, I kind of had a talk with my dad in my head. You know, I felt his presence. It sucks that he's physically not here and I can't share that with him, but I know, you know, whatever the deal is, I know my dad's proud.
What did you say to him?
You know, I said, we did it, you know, we did it. And I was just kind of making, I was making jokes, you know, 170, I guess you were right. You know, I should have listened to you. but the biggest thing is, you know, I just, you know, I said we did it, and I just said, Dad, that was for you. And I just thanked him. And it was short and sweet, but I like I said, I know he's proud. I know he's proud of not only me, but my brother that was cornering me. You know, he loved his family. He lived for his sons. So as long as we're happy, I know he's happy.
It's amazing to hear you talk about, like, not killing yourself by cutting down to 155. You used to fight at 145. It's incredible.
I know it.
And I can't imagine. Here you are. You look so healthy on the scale. I wish more people would, you know, go down the path that you're going down now. And I can't help but feel like, you know, last week I was talking about UFC 149. That was the first pay-per-view in the province of Alberta. You were supposed to fight Jose Aldo for the belt. You were supposed to fight him at UFC 153. Here you guys are, way back in the day, facing off.
Yeah.
How often do you think about what if you would have had a chance against the king back there, how life could have been different for you? Do you think about that a lot? Do you harp on it a lot?
You know, I used to, you know, especially when Connor fought him, cause you know, me and Duke Rufus would talk about it all the time. And I said the guy to dethrone Aldo would be a big featherweight and be a southpaw. And sure enough, Connor was the one to do it. You know, I wanted that spot. I wanted to do it. But I used to harp on it a lot, man. But what I noticed is I would always go back to, man, when I was getting ready for Aldo, that was the best Eric Koch. You know, I was unstoppable. Nobody could mess with me in the gym, you know. And then I started thinking, why am I going back? You know, I'm still fighting. Why am I going back to that as the best version of me? You know, So a couple years ago, man, I just had to let that go. So I harped on it, and a lot of times, even when people bring it up, you know, I was in Canada, I love Canada, but it, you know, I cringe every time people bring it up, just because it's one of those things. It didn't happen. And you know, obviously me, yes, I want to fight for a world title, but, I just want to let it go. You know, I want to let it go, and I want to, especially fighting at 70, I want to establish myself, here at this new weight class, and I want to create those new memories, man. I don't want to dwell on the past anymore.
Did you feel noticeably different in there because you didn't have to cut all that much weight?
I felt so much better, man. Not only physically, but mentally. My last two fights, I've cut so much weight, and not only that, I gained so much weight. Within that 24 hours, I think my last fight against Bobby Green, I weighed in at 55, and the next day, before I walked out there, they weighed me, and I was 185. I gained 30 pounds.
Wow.
That's 30 pounds of water, man. That's not 30. I'm not gaining any muscle. That's not functional weight. You know, it's essentially like I'm putting a weight vest of water on, you know, and you can notice in both my two last fights, my two last losses, Clay Guida and Bobby Green, I have a good first round. And then after that, my legs are gone. It's not a question of my lung capacity or am I tired? It's just my muscles can't sustain all that weight, you know? So, that's why even this fight, all the interviews I did, I was a big advocate. I think cutting weight's stupid, man. And I'm here telling you, look at Rumble Johnson, man. That guy started at 70. Now look at the guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's huge. But you know, I think more fighters are becoming aware of it now. I mean, even my teammate Anthony Pettis, you know, fighting Wonder Boy, and now he's fighting Diaz at 170. Even Chiesa. You're seeing a lot of these guys. You're seeing a lot of 55ers moving up. You're even seeing, you know, all through the UFC, you're seeing people moving up weight classes now. And I think it's smart. I think it's the right way to go.
Did you see that video of Aspen Ladd a couple of weeks ago on the scale shaking as she was weighing in before her fight against Jermaine Durandamy? Did you see that?
Man. Yeah, man. I'll tell you, everybody cuts a little bit of weight. I know fight week for this UFC, we had a couple people in our locker room, not our locker room, but our warm up room, cutting weight, and just how much I don't miss, you know, trying to sweat out those last few pounds or toweling up in a hot room and just, you know, killing yourself. I don't miss it at all.
Yeah. I feel like at some point something tragic is going to happen, and it has happened in other organizations, but never, you know, on the UFC stage. Do you get that feeling as
right.
well? Like they have dodged some bullets here, you know, like Barao. Remember he was cutting weight. He slipped. Oh. He hit his head. There's been some, Uriah Hall suffered a heart attack around 2 years ago while cutting weight. I feel like mm-hmm. something's going to happen. Do you fear that as well?
Oh, for sure, man. For sure. You know, it's one of those things. I did the same thing too, especially being a young fighter. I had people telling me, oh, you could cut to 45. A lot of people don't know I started my career at 55. I didn't even start at 45. I went to 45 because people said, oh, you could make the weight. Just because you can make a weight technically doesn't mean you should do it. And it's as simple as this, man. I think about how much I cut weight. I remember my last fight at 45 was against Dustin Poirier. And I remember making weight and I said, win, lose, or draw, there's no way in hell I'm doing this again. This is so unhealthy. And I was thinking about, you know, why am I cutting? Why am I cutting such a drastic amount of weight to then turn around in 24 hours and fight somebody in a cage? Like that just doesn't make any sense to me. If you think 10 pounds of water, 15 pounds of water is going to make the difference in you winning a fight, I think you have issues already, you know, just with your confidence going into a fight. You know, I don't think that should be the deciding factor of the fight. I think you're seeing more now. The reason fighters are going up is you got more speed, you got more stamina. You know, even in this fight, the guy I fought was way bigger than me, but I had a better gas tank. I was able to continue to press. I was able to grind. That's what happened to me the last two fights I had at 55, you know? So, I definitely don't want to see anything bad happening. I know boxing's going through a bunch of crazy stuff right now, just with the people passing in that. And, you know, that's another thing, man. When you cut weight and you don't have that water protecting your brain, it does damage and it does a lot.
Yep, absolutely. I love everything that you're saying. I agree with everything that you're saying. I hope more people listen to what you're saying so that we don't see a tragedy in our sport. Very well put on your part. When do you want to return? Do you want to make up for lost time here? Are you eager to get back in there?
Yes. Yes. I think the biggest thing right now in my career, because everybody's like, you know, you going for that strap. The end goal is always to go for the strap. You want to be a champ. If you don't want to be a champion in the UFC, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, I've always said that. So yeah, that's what I want to do. But what I was kind of telling everybody in an interview during the week is I want to Don Cerrone this. You know, I want to be able when the UFC calls, I can take a fight, and I want to be able to just stay active, because the biggest thing in my career, man, has been, and this goes back to cutting weight. This goes back to cutting weight. When I cut at 45 and 55, I need at least 2 to 3 months just to get my weight down. Like just to do it in a kind of safe way. I need that much time to get there. So my fights, I always have to schedule far out. And a lot of times what happens is when I'm cutting all this weight, my body becomes frail. And that's when I start tearing knees. You know, that's when I start hurting hands. And I start getting injured. I'm more injury prone. So the biggest thing at 70 is I'm not trying to be, you know, winning bodybuilding competitions here. I'm trying to stay active. I'm trying to stay healthy. And I'm trying to make up for lost time. Exactly what you said.
Who makes sense?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
as an opponent? Do you have someone in mind?
Oh, I have nobody in mind.
Okay,
I'm literally just, you know, let's just get the ball rolling, just knock them out. There's so many 170ers, man. I mean, really every division. There's so many 70ers, and even 55 that I fought at. There's so many people. I don't think it should be a problem to find somebody, but I want to bust them out, man, and I want a winning streak back.
Yes.
I had that going before the Aldo fight, and then after I got injured for that, it's just been up, down, and then long layoffs, up, down, long layoffs. You know, I want consistency. That's what I want.
And is it true we're no longer the new breed? Is that done?
We're no longer the new breed. And it's not taking it super seriously, but it was actually funny because my boxing coach, Coach Kush, back at Rufus Sport, he would always make fun of it. He'd poke fun at, well, what happens when the new breed gets older? Are you really the new breed? You know, and I was like, okay, that makes sense. But along with that, no, just Phoenix in the sense that, you know, I've always been a grinder. I've been through a lot, especially here recently, and just kind of, you know, nothing really affects me, even if, you know, I got a lot of stuff thrown my way and it, you know, it looks like I'm out. I will be reborn again, man. And I'll start every day is a new day, man. And with the way I'm trying to stay positive now, I need to, keep myself positive, especially, you know, losing my dad and all the injuries I've endured and everything like that. I just take it day by day, approach it, day by day, enjoy training. Enjoying, you know, going in there and training with all these savages and getting ready for a fight. I just do it day by day. So that was kind of the premise, you know, behind Phoenix. And, you know, I'm 30 years old. I guess I'm not the new breed anymore, you know?
So it's Eric Phoenix Coke now.
Yeah.
Rising from the ashes like a phoenix.
Rising from the ashes.
I love it. I love it, my man. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. I was so happy to see you back in the winner's circle. I was so happy to see you in a new weight class saying the things that you're saying. It's a great story, and I wish you nothing but the best. Thank you for doing this, Eric. Congratulations on the victory.
Hey, thanks, Ariel. I appreciate it, man. I really do.
Great to have you on the show. There he is, Eric Coke. No longer the new breed, now the Phoenix. Back and winning once again. Back at 170, didn't expect that. I remember him back in the WEC days, fighting at 145 pounds. Remember those stare downs, those two fights, 149, 153 against Jose Aldo, never came to fruition. Now here he is fighting at 170. That's unbelievable. What is that, 25 pounds? Yes, it's 25 pounds, not to mention all the weight that you're cutting. So a great story there. That was the start of the night in Edmonton, UFC 240, and then right before the two big fights at the top of the bill, main and co-main, we had an amazing fight between Jeff Neal and Nico Price. I mean, this was absolute bananas. Maybe the round of the year in round one, Jeff Neal once again victorious in the second round, and all he does is win in the UFC 4-0, coming from that great team in Dallas, Fortis MMA, head coach Saif Saud, doing great things with a lot of great young fighters. I love every minute of it, and it's great to have him on the show here for the very first time. There he is, the man, Jeff Neal. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, my friend. What a great victory. What a great run you're on these days. Is that the kind of fight that you like? Like, do you like a bananas fight like that where it's back and forth, you're getting hit, you're hitting the other guy, or do you prefer them a little cleaner?
I prefer them a little cleaner, but it was honestly fun. Like, I would love to do it again, but not anytime soon. I got to take 2 years off of that.
Yeah. Any serious injuries after that one?
No, not at all. I sprained my knee when he dropped me, but other than that, nothing certain.
Oh wow! So you actually did sprain your knee. How's it feel now?
It feels good. I went to go see our team doctor. He loosened it up, and I can train today if I wanted to.
Okay.
I'm
All right. One of my favorite moments of that fight, that didn't include the actual action itself, was right afterwards. Like, he came up to you and gave you this hug. And it was almost like, man, I wanted that, but I also respect you for that. Did you guys say anything to each other in that moment?
Honestly, I really don't remember. I was still kind of loopy from the first round. That headbutt really, fucked me up, but, can I cuss on there?
Yeah, sure. Go nuts.
Okay, cool. Yeah. But the headbutt really fucked me up. So, I really don't remember too much after that, but I think I hugged him. He said, I hate you. I love you. And then, we just went our separate ways.
Okay. What happened with that headbutt? Cause it seemed like both of you went in at the same time and there was an accidental headbutt, which dropped both of you. It reminded me of the Fedor Mitrione moment, except that was two punches. This time it seemed like a clash of heads. What happened there? Or what do you remember from what happened there?
I actually had to rewatch it. There was like a GIF on Twitter that showed it. He had hit me with a left as I was hitting him with a left, and, the force of the two punches pushed our heads together, and then the headbutt is what really dropped me.
Okay, and what did you feel in that moment right after?
Oh shit! I didn't feel nothing. All I remember is just looking up at the sky and him jumping on top of me, and I was like, oh shit, how the fuck did I get down here? He was on top of me, and I whispered in his ear. I was like, what was that?
Oh really?
Yeah. I asked him what was that.
Did he respond?
No, he didn't. He just kept on trying to punch me.
Yeah, I figured. Did you think, you know, it's funny. I saw Dan Migliotta, the referee for that fight, at the airport Sunday morning, and we were talking about that moment, and he was wondering, like, he said in the aftermath, he was wondering if he should have stopped it. And he spoke to Mark Ratner, he told me, who's, you know, the VP of regulatory affairs for the UFC, and asked if he did the right thing. And because both of you went in at the same time, it kind of canceled it out and he just kind of let it go. Do you feel like that was the right call, or do you think it should have been stopped because it was an accidental headbutt?
No, that was the right call. That was the right call. There was no need to stop the action of the fight. You know, the fight might have went different if he would have stopped it, you know? So, that was a good call.
Okay. I know your dad was in attendance. Your head coach, Saif, had a great video of you guys embracing afterwards. You seem really tight with your dad. He seems like, I mean, I saw a video on your Instagram, him going to all your fights and, even one, I think back in the day at a strip club, and he's, you know, shouting and cheering you on and why not. Could you tell me about the bond that you have with your old man?
We got a great bond. We're in a military family. He's a drill sergeant and all that. He raised me right, you know, and he's been there for every step of my career, even football. I was trying to pursue a professional football career. He was there for me from day one. I love him. I don't know what else to say about that.
Does he go to all your fights?
Yeah, all my fights. He almost didn't go to this one. Luckily, I had some sponsors help me out last minute, and we got him a plane. I got him a plane ticket, Wednesday, and flew him out. But he almost didn't make it, and I'm glad I got to, get him out here.
Has he ever missed any of your fights?
No, never. This would have been the first one if we didn't get him a ticket.
And why was this one down to the 11th hour, so to speak? Why couldn't he go beforehand?
Just because money was getting tight. I had money in my savings account that I couldn't pull out immediately. So it was a tough time. And then I reached out to a couple of my sponsors. They helped me with some money. Then I got him out.
Wow, that's great. Okay, who are these sponsors? Let's give them some love.
Let's give them love. I don't know the name of it's a Hailscope, Michael Millen.
Okay.
He has a hail restoration company in San Antonio, I think. And that's the one that really pulled through with the sponsorship.
Well done. Well done. That was a great moment with you guys hugging. I saw that you also posted a video where, it was around 5 or so years ago. You had a great win, but you said that your dad, I think he drove you like 13 hours straight to Lake Charles, Louisiana, cause you were kind of, you were being a bit of a mess up. You were drinking a lot. You weren't kind of focusing on your career. What was that drive like? Like, how did that drive and that experience get you on the right track?
It just woke me up, yeah. Because like I said, I was drinking a lot. I feel like I was just depressed. I was going through a tough time mentally, and I didn't know where I wanted to be. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know fighting was honestly the thing for me. And it was actually St. Charles, Missouri.
Oh, okay, my bad. Louisiana. Yep.
Yeah, that's all good.
But, I knew there was a Charles in there, right? I got part of it right.
Yeah. You know, we drove up there. The fight was at 185 pounds, so I didn't have to really cut. I wore the sauna suit the whole time to cut like 5 pounds of water while I was driving. But it was against a dude. He was 2-0. They pretty much were bringing me in to lose. But I went in there, got the knockout, and it reignited a fire in me. It made me remember why I love doing this sport.
So on that drive, 13 hours? Was it 13 hours long?
13 hours.
Yeah, on that drive, like, what did you guys talk about? How did he get you like in the right mindset?
Honestly, we didn't talk too much. I slept the whole time. I sleep when I'm in the car, but I just listen to music, and my dad doesn't say much. He just, his presence is enough to get me motivated.
And you knew that he was kind of upset with the way that you were going, the path that you were going on?
I wouldn't say he was upset. I would say he was more disappointed than anything.
Okay.
You know, I'm back home living with him. I'm 20-something years old. I'm a grown-ass man, you know, just doing dumb shit. So he found me a fight and found me something to do, and I got that win, and I thank God for that.
Why were you depressed?
I don't know. It's I really can't pinpoint why I'm depressed, but why I was depressed, but I think it just has something to do with just alcoholism. Like, you know, I was drinking way too much. I was in Houston before that and drinking every day, partying. Didn't have enough money for rent, so I had to move back to home with my parents. So that was kind of depressing to me.
How much were you drinking every night?
How much? Shit. I mean, like, it wasn't... It's not like I was getting wasted every night, but it's like I had to have like a couple beers to go to sleep.
Okay. Oh, you know wow. What I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things.
And your dad found you a fight?
Yeah, my dad found me a fight.
Yes, wow. That's, is he your manager?
No, he's not my manager, but back then I had no management. I had no like direction. So that, before I came to Dallas and was with my coach, Safe, but he was pretty much like the dictator. Like he'll find me fights and every now and then, but. Yeah, that's pretty much how it was.
What is going on at Fortis these days? How come you guys are on this roll? What's in the secret sauce over there? It's amazing. It's like I said at the top, there's no like number one contender on the team just yet, but I feel like this time this year, there's going to be multiple number one contenders across multiple divisions. And it's, I mean, I've seen the way Safe works the corner. I see the connection that he has with you guys. I had the privilege of going to the gym around 2.5 or so years ago when the UFC was in Dallas for UFC 211. It's a beautiful facility, but it just seems like you guys are on the rise. Like we know about ATT, we know about AKA, we know about Jackson Wink and all those places, but every week it seems like there's another Fortis fighter who's like, wow, that's a guy that we need to pay attention to. This week it was your turn. What's happening there that's making you guys go on this kind of run?
We have an amazing team. We all work hard. We're all goal driven. We're all winners. Everybody loves to win. Everybody wants to win. Everybody wants to be champion in the UFC. So I think that mindset just it rubs off on everybody, and we work so damn hard. It's crazy.
It's
hard work.
What makes Safe such a good coach?
His leadership is meant like, everything makes him a good coach. He has the perfect game plan all the time. He's always there. Man, I got so many things, dude. I'm sorry. I'm at a loss for words right now.
Okay. Cause he's that special to you.
No, he's that special to me.
Okay. I also understand that Darren Williams, the former NBA All-Star, is a part owner of the team. Is he at the gym from time to time? You ever roll with him?
No, I haven't rolled with him. Actually, one time when he first came to the gym, I rolled with him, but he's really strong. He's pretty good. But he hasn't been there lately.
Okay. He's a big boy. Correct me if I'm wrong. I understand that you work as a waiter, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you, the night before you went to Edmonton, you worked a night shift, went home, packed, and then didn't go to bed, and then went on the plane, correct?
Yeah, straight to the plane.
How often do you work as a waiter?
Often, Friday, Saturday, Sundays right now.
And what
kind, on the weekend.
What kind of restaurant?
It's a bar and grill. It's downtown. It's pretty upscale. It turns into like, it's the spot where everybody goes the pregame before they go out to the club.
Okay, and at some point, I'm assuming you want to drop that gig and just focus on the fighting, correct?
Yes, 100%.
Are we close to that?
Not yet, but we're getting there. We're getting there.
I'm sure the performance of the night bonus helps.
Oh, yeah, it helps for sure. And all I'm going to do is put that money aside, keep it in the bank, and pretty much all I use working for is to pay my bills, so I don't use my fight money.
Okay. Now, like when you have performances like this, like when you fight UFC the weekend before and then you go back to work, do you start to get people who recognize you and be like, oh, I saw you on TV? Has that happened yet?
I haven't yet, but I'm pretty sure now, because this fight was a little bit more of a high profile than my last couple fights, I'll probably get some people that would recognize me.
Okay. And do you feel like this is the one that's going to get you into the rankings? Do you feel like you've reached that point?
Yeah, I'm hoping, but it is what it is. You know, I'm just happy I got the win, and I'm just going to enjoy my victory for right now.
Okay. When do you want to return?
2 months. About 2 months. 2 months, I'll be ready to go and ready to throw some hands again.
Yes, and I'm assuming they call you Hands of Steel because of the fact that you hit really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
Pretty self-explanatory. Do you have someone in mind that you want to fight next?
Nobody in mind. I would love to fight Mike Perry, but you have to get through Vicente Luque first. But
yes. Oh, I like that. Yeah, he's fighting in less than 2 weeks. So if he beats Luque, you'd like platinum next. Why him?
It's a perfect fight for the fans, you know. Like, you know, it's just like me and Nico fight. We promised fireworks. We promised that it was going to be exciting and fast paced, and that's what happened. And if I fight Mike Perry, it's going to be the same thing, same result.
And is it true that you saw Nico around like a year or so ago? You guys were on the treadmill and kind of eyed each other down, and you knew back then that this was inevitable. Yeah. Where was this?
Yeah, this is before the fight card here in Dallas when he fought one of my teammates, Razak, but. I was on the treadmill and he was in the room stretching, and then we locked eye contact. So I turned up the speed on the treadmill and I started running crazy, just like, you know what I mean? Just me mugging him. It was kind of weird, but.
And now, he's a bit of a quirky fellow, correct?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, but.
I like him though. I like it.
No, he's a great guy and he always puts on fun fights. And I understand a lot of people don't want to fight him these days. I understand the UFC has had a hard time finding him an opponent. You stepped up to the plate and got a great win. And did Edmonton treat you well? Did the Canadians treat you well?
Yeah, they treated me great. I love Canada. It was an awesome country. I would love to go again sometime.
That's right. I like to hear it, Jeff. I like to hear it. As a proud Canadian myself, we appreciate that nod. Congratulations on the win, my man. Enjoy it. Well done. It's been fun seeing you climb that ladder, and I hope you get a big fight next. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate you having me out there.
All right, there he is. Jeff Neal, 4-0 now in the UFC. He's on some kind of roll coming off that win over Nico Price. And I want to tell you, should I do this first? Okay, I'll do this in a second. Let me do the ad read first. I wanted to give an update on something, but let me do the ad read first. Or should I do this first? I'll do the ad read first. This first? Ad read first.
Ad read first.
Was that to the world?
Ad read first.
Was that to the world?
Yes.
He's found his voice. Corporate Jake is how was Edmonton, Corporate Jake? You were there. Did you like it?
It was beautiful.
What about my my hyping up of Rogers Place?
It was gorgeous.
That's
it? You weren't lying at all.
I wasn't. Why are you so short? Well, like, give us some color here. Give us some answers here. Give us some words.
We got to get the ad read in.
That's it?
Got to make money.
See? Corporate Jake. Never fails. All right. Let me tell you about my good friends over at Vivid Seats. I love Vivid Seats. You know I love Vivid Seats because they're the ones who sponsored our very first road show. As you take a look at Mr. Hands of Steel's handiwork. What is going on here? Okay. Anyway, sorry. Vivid Seats. I love these people. They're the best. They supported us. And you know, on this show, unlike other shows, I don't like to have people on the show or sponsors a part of the show who are like, you know, people I don't really believe in, companies I don't believe in, products I don't believe in. No, I believe in Vivid Seats because they offer a great service. You want to go to a game? You want to go to an event? You want to go to a fight? You want to go to a theater thing or whatever you call it, the Broadway play, you know, those things? You want to go to one of those? Go to Vivid Seats. It's an online event ticket marketplace dedicated to providing fans of live entertainment with experiences that last a lifetime. With Vivid Seats, listeners can watch their favorite teams and artists perform in person. Vivid Seats helps fans find their seats to any of their favorite live events, including sports, concerts, theater, and more. Concerts, that's the word I was looking for. Vivid Seats offers great prices and an easy purchasing experience. Listen to this. With the code KNOCKOUT, that's KNOCKOUT, my listeners can receive 10% off their first purchase with Vivid Seats. Go to the App Store or Google Play right now and download the Vivid Seats app. First time customers can enter promo code KNOCKOUT right now to receive 10% off your first order. All Vivid Seats orders are backed by 100% guarantee. 100%. If you don't like them, come to me. I'll make it right. Vivid Seats. Support them because they support us. As you may have heard last night, in Gilroy, California, a town that I went to not that long ago, there was a horrific shooting, multiple casualties, a town where Daniel Cormier, Cain Velasquez, Luis Pena, Deron Wynn, a lot of the AK fighters, they live and they're known for their garlic. It's the garlic capital of the world. They have a yearly garlic festival. And unfortunately, at that festival, there was a shooting. And like I said, multiple people passed away, including a 6-year-old boy, a horrific tragedy. And, from what I understand, I spoke briefly with DC, the community is rocked and everyone's very sad over this and obviously rightfully so. Cain Velasquez, who's a very proud Gilroy resident, posted this on Twitter not that long ago. We were trying to get in touch with him. He's on his way actually to Mexico to make his Lucha Libre debut, but we couldn't get him in time before he was boarding the plane. He said, quote, "My heart is broken over the senseless violence that occurred in my community of Gilroy. I pray for Steven Romero and his family as well as for all the victims. My family also had very close friends in attendance at the festival only feet away from where everything happened. Gilroy is my home, and I want to do whatever I can to support our community. I also want to thank Gilroy PD for their incredible work. My Lucha Libre debut on August 3rd is dedicated to Steven, all the victims affected, and the entire community of Gilroy. Hashtag Gilroy Strong. My heart and prayers go out to my community in Gilroy, California. I can't believe there was a shooting at the Gilroy Garlic Festival. That was earlier in the evening. He posted that. So a horrific tragedy, and Cain Velasquez posting moments ago that he is dedicating his Lucha Libre debut to the victims of last night's shooting. We want to send our condolences to them as well. All right, now let's go back to the UFC 240 story. I have been somewhat down on the state of Canadian MMA for quite some time. I haven't seen a lot of up-and-comers on the scene. I haven't seen a lot of prospects fighting on the regional circuit, potential number one contenders, potential future champions. And then UFC 240 happened, and all of a sudden I'm feeling a little better about the state of Canadian MMA. Jillian Robertson with a nice win. Gavin Tucker back on the winning track. How about Felicia Spencer, who lost but also performed valiantly against Chris Cyborg? And then how about Hakeem Daoudou, who had a great win over Yoshinori Horie in the prelims, third round TKO, back and forth they went, an amazing finish, and I feel like this man is at the top of that list as far as rising stars in Canadian MMA, and maybe no longer a rising star. Maybe he is here, and he's kind enough to join us right now via the magic of Skype. Hakeem, how are you?
Good, man. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and congratulations on the victory. That one, I feel like, was a big one for you, getting a finish in Canada, your first finish in the UFC. Are you happy with your performance?
Yeah, I'm definitely happy. You know, I wasn't too happy with the first two rounds. I felt, you know, it was a bit awkward. I was, you know, a bit hesitant. But once I got a hold of him and I was able to implicate my game plan and start putting the pressure on him, you know, I felt good about that. But other than that, yeah, I'm very happy about the win and getting my first KO in the UFC.
It seemed like you were frustrated. You said that, or at least you sort of alluded to the fact that you felt like he was running, that he was too elusive. Did you feel like, you know, he wasn't coming to fight, that he was just coming to avoid you?
Yeah, you know, I watched, you know, just, I know watching fights doesn't mean everything, but I watched prior some of his older fights, and, you know, that didn't seem like his style. He seemed like he was ready to stand in front of me and bang. And, you know, that was a really weird, awkward running style. I haven't really, you know, fought too many people that, you know, fight like that. So at first, yeah, it took some getting used to, but once I figured him out, I, you know, felt like I'd get the finish.
I remember when you came into the UFC, you were undefeated, had that fight against Danny Henry, and of course it did not go your way. It lasted just 39 seconds. And I was like, wow. I mean, again, I thought that, okay, here comes the new breed. Here's a fresh faced Canadian fighter. This is part of that new wave of great Canadian fighters. And of course it didn't go your way. Since then, 3-0, and now you get your first finish. Do you feel like now you have finally put that loss behind you, that now you're on a roll, you're comfortable in the UFC?
Yeah, I feel like I'm just getting comfortable. And, you know, most important, I'm just, I was healthy this fight. You know, my last couple of fights, I had, you know, some minor injuries with the torn shoulders, you know. So this fight camp, you know, I got the PRP. I felt healthy. I felt strong. And I was really looking and pushing to get back to my KO ways.
How did you react to that loss to Danny Hendry? Like, your UFC debut would last 39 seconds. How did you react, and how long did it take for you to get over it?
I know it wasn't, you know, it was weird. Like, I know I always pictured myself being one of those undefeated fighters, but the way I took that one, I was like, wow, you know, it's not that bad. Like, you know, it wasn't really that bad. You know, I just feel like I can, you know, get back to the drawing boards and just be better. So I think if anything, it made me, you know, a better fighter.
Really? So is it maybe like the undefeated streak is sort of like a weight lifted off your shoulders? Now you don't have to worry about that first loss anymore?
No, you know, definitely. I never want to lose again. I never want to, you know, I want that to be my only loss ever. And if I have a chance to, you know, avenge that, you know, later down the road, if it makes sense, you know. But, no, I feel like it definitely made me a better fighter. And I feel like I learned a lot from that and, you know, new and evolved. You know, I feel like a brand new person. I'm in love with the sport again. I love fighting again. I'm excited. And I feel like I'm only getting better.
You say, like, I feel like a brand new person again. I feel like I love fighting again, things like that. When you say again, that makes me think that you lost your love for the game. Is that accurate?
Yeah, definitely. I felt stale a little bit. You know, there's a bit there where I was in between contracts. I wasn't fighting too frequent, you know, trying to get into the UFC. And, you know, that Danny Hendry fight, you know, just being injured and dealing with, you know, just the stress of training and not being 100%. You know, I was at a loss of, you know, where I wanted to be. You know, I was, you know, undefeated. All of a sudden I had this quick finish, never been finished before out of any of my fights, amateur, you know. You know, that was a lot to take. But, you know, I came back stronger. And, yeah, I feel, you know, like a brand new person in love with the sport. You know, in love with training again, and I got that fire back.
And so now you've won 3 in a row in Canada. Do you hear people like me say, oh, like, oh, Canadian MMA, there's no GSP, where's the next Roy, things like that. Do you hear that talk, and does it bother you? Do you take it personally? Do you feel like here I am, I'm the next guy, pay attention to me?
Yeah, definitely it bothers me. But, you know, the best way to, you know, start making some notice is getting those big KOs and start making a wave and, you know, start getting noticed. So that's what I'm going to keep doing now that I'm healthy, just keep getting these KOs, keep putting these people away and really getting my name out there and representing the country.
Do you feel like the state of Canadian MMA isn't as bad as people think? Like, do you see a new wave of guys? Do you feel like there is a crop of people coming up that people should be excited about?
Definitely. I think every, you know, country has their waves, you know what I mean? Canada, you know, every country, you know, kind of has their waves. And I feel like Canada, you know, is having their new wave coming up. And there's some good prospects that are on the rise that people need to look out for.
Yeah. So in that fight, you got the finish, and there was a time, I know you said that you felt like he was a little elusive, but you were hitting him with some big shots. And there was like a stretch there where I was like, wow, what is it going to take to put this guy away? Were you thinking that as well at any point?
Yeah, you know, but he was also, you know, he's kind of, he had some weird movement, you know. I didn't get to catch him as flush as I wanted to at first. And, you know, he was just, you know, a very a good test, I guess, you know, just to see something that awkward and unique. And I think just the way he was moving, that's why I wasn't catching him as clean as I wanted to. But once I caught him clean, I feel like, you know, the referee could have maybe let it go a little bit longer, but if he wanted to stop it, I'm happy with that as well.
It's funny you bring that up. I was just about to ask you about that. So you actually think it was a premature stoppage?
Not premature. Either way, it wasn't premature, but, you know, I've seen some fights go a bit longer. Either way, it would have been the same outcome.
Right. Your nickname, as we saw earlier, is Mean Hakeem. You never smile. What makes you smile? What makes you happy, Hakeem?
You know, I'm just like everybody else. You know, I smile. I crack jokes all the time. I think me and Akeem is just my fight persona. You know, that's kind of the nickname I got, especially because I used to put a lot of people away. I have a high KO ratio. But that's just like, you know, the fight name. Other than that, I'm just like, you know, as regular as everybody else. I smile. I crack jokes. I like to have fun, you know.
By the way, I think the speaker from your headphones is like rubbing up against your bling bling over there. You see that? So it's like creating a bit of a weird sound. You got a lot there, huh?
Sorry,
you got
about
that. Yeah. Oh, is it the rings?
You know, it might be the rings, I think. I'll make sure I won't have.
You got so much ice there, I can skate on you, Hakeem.
You know, just a couple chains, you know, my good luck chains. I like to keep these during fight week, and you know, they've been good luck, and it's always kind of been my look. And my colors, black and gold, those are my favorite colors. Every time I saw my T-shirts and my when I used to come out with my wardrobe, it was always black and gold. So, you know, gold and black has always been my favorite color, so I always like to make sure I'm rocking them.
What do the necklaces represent? Like, why are they good luck?
I got this necklace. It was like my first, when I decided to first turn pro in MMA and have my first MMA fight. I got this chain when I won my WMC world title in Muay Thai back in the day as a pro. You know, they just been kind of good luck necklaces that I like to keep around with me.
Okay. And I just want to go back to the mean thing for a second, because you do, like, you have like a scowl, like when you weigh in and stuff, like it's pretty intimidating. Like, that frown, has anyone ever told you that? That frown is heavy stuff.
Yeah. You know, I've heard that, you know, it's the fight business, you know, where I'm here to, you know, put on the pressure and let people feel that I'm you're here for a real fight. And, you know, I want to be taken serious as a top contender.
There it is. We get a sense of it right over there from the photo. What happened with the weigh-ins? You were the last guy to weigh in. There was 5 minutes left, and there was a big gap between you and everyone else. What happened there? How close were you to not making weight?
I was, like, there was, like, probably 30 minutes left, and I was, like, 0.4 over, you know what I mean? So I had to, like, run into the sauna for, like, 10 minutes. And then, you know, dry myself off and then, you know, run back to the hotel. But when we weighed myself on my scale, I was 146 right on the dot. We got on the UFC official scale, 146 on the dot. So, you know, it wasn't like a crazy bad cut, because as you can see, I still perform. My cardio was fine. Just this camp, I came in a little bit too big.
Okay.
It's not going to happen again.
You've never missed weight in your entire combat
never
sports?
Never missed weight.
Right.
Never okay. missed weight.
And that includes Muay Thai, amateur? Right.
Yeah, I've had, you know, I think last night, like, altogether, my fights, that was probably, like, my 70th fight. I've never missed weight one time.
Wow.
And I wasn't planning on to that time either.
Now, it's over and done with, but the elephant in the room is that people were saying that you were touching the towel. You were doing the old Daniel Cormier. Can you confirm or deny that tactic?
Know, I saw that. There was no tactics like that. You know, I was just... You know, it was a little bit of a cut. You know what I mean? I just had my hands in front.
Yeah.
You know, it was keeping my balance. I was looking at the scale, and it said 146 on the dot. That's why I was so ecstatic. It was a push.
That's right. No harm, no foul, as they say.
No harm, no foul.
And I understand you have come from, you know, you have overcome a lot, I should say. Correct me if I'm wrong. You used to be in juvenile detention, and that's how you were sort of exposed to combat sports. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I went to juvie for a bit, and my probation officer, you know, one of the orders was I had to go to anger management, and I kept missing my anger management, so she didn't want to breach me. So she told me, you know, why don't you try martial arts, and we can write martial arts as off as anger management, and that's kind of how I started with the Muay Thai kickboxing.
Wow. So prior to that, you had no experience in martial arts?
No, you know, when I was younger, I used to do Taekwondo as a kid, you know, when I was like 6 years old. You know, when I was 12 years old, I used to box. But it wasn't until I was, you know, 16, 17, where I really started taking fighting seriously.
Okay. And why were you in juvie?
You know, just, I used to get in trouble as a young kid, you know, doing little stints here and there. And, you know, you get caught. And, you know, it was one of those experiences in life that, you know, made me who I am today.
How long were you there for?
The first, you know, basically, I think the first time I ever went to juvie, I think I was like 13 or 14. You know, they'd let you out. You'd be out for like a couple months, back in for something else. I got caught with a home invasion when I was 16. I was 16. It was one of the more serious ones where I got caught with a couple of things. And I was in for about 6 months, and they let me out on house arrest for a year. And all I was allowed to do was work, go to school, and go to the gym and the anger management. And that's how I started, you know, falling in love with the kickboxing.
Wow. Did you ever go to jail or just juvie?
It was just juvie, you know what I mean? Because if I was over 18, that's why I wanted to, you know, change everything up, because I didn't want to be, you know, not being able to allow to be able to fight in the States. So, you know, I luckily, you know, I was 17, because here, you know, adults 18. So luckily, you know, I got rid of, you know, all the bad habits before I was officially an adult.
Well, and why did they want you to go to anger management?
You know, just, you know, part of just lifestyle, you know, always getting into fights, you know, always getting into trouble, you know, is just one of those orders when you're on house arrest, you know, one of those orders they want you to follow to make sure, you know, you're going to change your ways.
So is that where the Mean nickname comes from?
No, the Mean nickname doesn't come from that, actually. The Mean nickname comes from, I remember when I first started kickboxing, I think I was like 5-0 or something like that. And, you know, I was just beating all my opponents, you know, with points. And I remember my coach, John Mike Miles, he always used to make little posts about the fights. And he said something about, like, Akeem has very good technique but lacks killer instinct. And after that post, I read that. I had about, like, I swear, I think it was like 10 knockouts in a row as an amateur. And that's where the nickname came from.
Okay. Wow, home invasion. That's serious stuff, Akeem.
You know, just young and dumb, you know, but, you know, those are years behind me, and right now I'm just a full-on athlete.
Yeah, and I understand you give back to the community, right? Like, don't you talk to kids to try to teach them to not go down the path you did?
Yeah, definitely. We've had a couple of talks, you know what I mean? I plan on doing more. I welcome more, and, you know, and I'm just one of those guys. I'm just, you know, enjoying life right now.
Do you get people who reach out to you now that you're getting a little more famous, who know about your story, who tell you that you're an inspiration, you know, helping them to change their lives? Have you been able to reach that point yet?
Yeah, I think even before that, you know what I mean? Even when I was just, you know, before I got in the UFC and I was fighting in other leagues, when I was just kickboxing, a lot of people from the community used to come up to me, you know, holler at me. And, I, you know, I'm still involved in the community. I hang out with a lot of people. And, you know, of course, I get it all the time.
I love it. When do you want to return?
I wanted to get back for Vancouver September 14th.
Oh, yes.
I'm just going to get a quick x-ray at my leg. They just want to make sure it's not broken.
Oh.
And it don't feel broken to me, but, you know, I just make sure, be safe, make sure there's no fractures in there. And, you know, take about a week to recover and definitely just make the call from there.
Who do you want to fight on that card?
You know, I haven't even, you know, I was just kind of focused on my last opponent. I haven't even looked at, you know, who I want to fight now, but I welcome anybody and everybody. You know, I don't shy away from a fight. I'm a real fighter. I'm here to, you know, beat anybody in that top 15, top 10 to get to the top spot, because I want to start making a name for myself.
I like it. And I like the fact that you want to fight in Canada. Let's keep this thing. The Mean new face of Canada. Why not? Right?
Yeah, definitely. I want to be the face of Canadian MMA. I've been working a long time, and I feel like I'm in my prime, and I feel like it's my time to shine now, finally.
I mean, the state of Canadian MMA is that a Hawaiian is the face of Canadian MMA. We can't have that, right? I mean, we all love Max Holloway, but he's a Hawaiian.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't even make sense. He's not even Canadian, so definitely, yeah, that doesn't even make sense. So I never even paid attention to that. You know, I got to be the face of Canadian MMA, and the new wave's coming up. You know, people just need to be on the lookout.
Have you ever met GSP?
I've never met GSP, actually, no. There's been a couple of talks of me going down to the TriStar gym and training. You know, but we'll see in the future what happens.
All right. Well, it's great to have you on the show for the first time, Akeem. Congratulations on the win, on the run that you've been on as of late, 3-0 in your last three fights, and well done representing our country, my man, as I lift my flag over here. I'm just soaking in all this Canadianness. I mean, it's great to be us. It was a great weekend in Edmonton. Well done. We're happy for you. We're proud of you, and keep it up.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me on the show, man. I appreciate it.
All right. There he is. Great story there. Unbelievable. Wow. He's been through a lot, has overcome a lot. A true inspiration. Mean Hakeem Daoudou joining us on the program. 7 of his 10 wins by knockout, including Saturday's victory over Yoshinori Horie. And he has 3 wins in Canada since 2018. That's most among all UFC fighters. So great stuff there from Mean Hakeem. And let's keep this Canadian theme rolling along here. I like this. First 4 guests today are all first timers. In fact, I think Actually, Nick Lentz may have been on the show way back in the day, but the first four are definitely first timers. And like I said, let's keep the Canadian theme rolling along. So Amin Hakim has won three in Canada since 2018. Our next guest picked up her first win in Canada on Saturday. Great win for Jillian Robertson, who I feel is a rising star, not only for Canadian MMA, but in the UFC's women's flyweight division. And she joins us right now via the magic of Skype. Jillian, how are you?
I'm doing great. You know, still high off that win off this weekend, my first TKO, and especially being in front of the Canadian crowd. It was just amazing.
I love it. We go from a Hakim who's like constantly frowning to you who's constantly smiling. It's a great juxtaposition.
I feel like I can't help it, but I don't know. It's a different personality when I get in the cage.
That's right. Yes, in the cage you're much different. We'll get to that in a second. But just being in Canada for the first time, fighting in Canada, winning in Canada, what did that mean to you?
Oh, it means the world to me. It's like my last three or four fights, I'm pretty sure, have been in my opponent's hometown. It's like I fought a girl from Sao Paulo in Sao Paulo. I fought Molly McCann in Liverpool. And it's like walking out to those fights, I'm getting booed. And so it's like to have the crowd behind me for the first time was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and to even fight like in North, because they sent you, what, to Brazil, to Prague, to, where was it, England, right? So just to have like a short flight must have been nice in its own right, correct?
It was still a little bit of a long flight for me. I'm coming from Florida,
right.
So it was still like an 8 or 9 hour flight, but it was amazing. Like I said, the crowd support was just incredible, and it makes a difference in the cage, you know, when you hear everybody cheering for you, everybody there for you. It's amazing.
So how is someone who is, you know, so smiley, so pleasant, how do you turn on that switch to become the way you are in the cage? Because in the cage, like you are, as your nickname suggests, you're a savage in there. Like you are aggressive. You go for the kill. It's a lot of fun to watch you fight. What do you do to go from the person we're seeing right now to the person we see in the cage?
Honestly, for me, it's just a sport. I look at MMA as like playing football, playing soccer. So it's like, I don't really have to get aggressive. I don't have to be angry or anything like that. I just need to be focused and calm when I walk into the cage and make sure that I can execute my technique to my best ability.
And what about the hair? What does the hair represent?
Oh, honestly, I don't really know why I did it in the first place. I did it right before my first pro fight, and then I feel like it just became a thing. Like, that's how people know me, so I'm kind of stuck with it now.
Always the same color?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And do you only color it before your fights, or do you keep it consistent regardless of if you're fighting or not?
I try to keep it consistent, but I'm not necessarily the girliest girl, so okay. I definitely struggle with that. But always before fights, I got to make sure it's on point.
Who introduced you to mixed martial arts?
I really have no idea what got me into it in the first place. When I was 16 years old, I started a cardio kickboxing class at Dean's Gym just because I really don't know. I just wanted to try cardio kickboxing.
Wow.
And I did it. So I was in there with like a bunch of soccer moms. And then like 2 or 3 months later, one of my friends, he wrestled at my high school, and he was like, oh, why don't you try the MMA class? So then I just went and I tried it, and I got addicted, I guess. I started training every single day. I was training like 2 or 3 times a day. And then after 2 years, Dean was just like, all right, you want to take a fight? And then I took my first amateur fight and I fell in love.
And when you say Dean, you mean Dean Thomas?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so you're already in Florida at this time.
Yes, I started training with Dean when I was 16, and I literally never played a sport or anything else before that.
Wow, that is wild. And why were you in Florida?
My parents moved down to Florida when I was about 7. So, I've grown up in Florida, but, I was born in Canada. My grandparents live up there, and that's always going to be a home.
Okay. So do you associate with being Canadian more so than American, or both? What do you lean towards?
A little bit of both, I guess. Like, I feel like I said, my family's all up in Canada, so my roots are definitely there, but I'm definitely a Florida girl too. So I've got the dual citizenship going for me.
Nice. I think you sound Canadian. I think you still have that Canadian accent. Do you ever hear that?
I've definitely heard that a few times. I don't think I hear it in myself, but I've definitely been told that.
Okay. And so this is all like something, like you never planned for any of this. Are you surprised with how well you're doing, how far you've come?
Yeah, when I first signed up for like that cardio kickboxing class, I didn't know what the UFC was. I didn't know the UFC existed or anything like that. And I actually never watched my first UFC fight until after I had my first amateur fight.
Wow.
But so yeah, I guess you could say I don't know. It feels unreal to me that I'm even this far, that it's going so well for me. It's just it's like I found it and I just found my passion and I've ran with it.
What do you think you would have done had you not found this passion?
Honestly, I've worked a lot with animals before I started training. So I volunteered at the Humane Society. I volunteered at horse rescues, wildlife rescues, things like that. So I always wanted to be a vet when I was growing up. But then once I found kickboxing, it changed everything.
Okay. Do you still work with animals now or you just focus on the fighting?
I just focus on fighting 100% right now. I have a pit bull who's 12 years old, who's my best friend. And my dad's currently manager at the Humane Society, so it's like we're still involved with it.
Wow. So your pit bull is your best friend, legitimate?
100%. He's my roommate, he's my everything. I need to go pick him up for my parents right now, and I'm missing him so much.
Oh wow. What's his name?
Robin. Like Batman and Robin.
Oh, okay. Well, so you're the Batman, he's the Robin, I'm assuming.
Before I adopted him from the shelter, he had a brother named Batman who got adopted before he did. So it was Batman and Robin.
I love that. That's great. I'd like to meet Robin one of these days. Okay. So now things are going well. And I feel like you're perfect for this weight class. In fact, we just put up a little stat right over there. You have the most wins in UFC women's flyweight history. It's been a very short history, but you're doing very well. Do you feel like you're one of the byproducts of opening up this division? Like, would 115 or 135 just not have been good for you? 125 just perfect?
125 is definitely 100% perfect for me. All my fights outside of the UFC were at 115, and I was getting to the point where I was having trouble make that weight still, and literally the division opened up just right in time perfectly for me. Like, when I started fighting, I was 18 years old, so I was still younger, and then once I was turning pro, I just started growing up a little bit more, and I gained a little bit of weight, and I feel like where I used to walk around at 122, I'm walking around at 140 now. And so I really just needed the 125 division.
You're known for your ground game. You're known for your submissions. You pick up your first KO/TKO win. Was that something that you wanted to do, to tell people that you're not just a BJJ practitioner, that you can actually finish fights in other ways?
I'm always submission hunting, I feel like. I was definitely going in there looking for the submission, but I was very unhappy with my last fight against Veronica Macedo, because I literally didn't throw a single strike in that fight. It was so much straight jujitsu, and I want to be a mixed martial artist. I want to be able to use all my weapons. So I was trying to display my grappling and my ground and pound a little bit more during this fight, but it definitely feels good to come out with the TKO. I wasn't expecting it, but I was just using the strike to hopefully soften her up and get the submission.
So a nice little surprise there. So you say you were unhappy with your last fight, which was a win, but prior to that was a loss where you were actually submitted. I can't imagine how disappointed you were about that, considering it was a submission.
Oh, that fight, literally, I've never had any fight that was harder for, like, that was my worst loss ever. I feel like it's like my first pro fight I lost, but I was like, all right, it's my first fight. It was a close fight. Still, my second loss was against Cynthia Caveo, and I took that fight on 5 days notice. So I still kind of had an excuse for myself, but that was the first fight where I'm like, all right, this girl, like, she really beat me. Like, she took me out of there, and it really like haunted. Like, I try to be positive about everything. I come out and I'm always making the best of every situation, but every single morning I'd wake up and I'd just think about that moment, think about me tapping. And it really just haunted me for months and months, and I couldn't get away from it. So it definitely pushed me harder. And I can't say any fight has changed me more than that fight, though. I feel like that fight made me a stronger fighter, and it's just going to push me more and more, because I never am going to let any girl make me feel like that again.
How did you eventually get over it, or are you not over it?
I feel like after that fight, I came back in the locker room and I was sobbing, crying. And I'm like, all right, you got like 30 minutes and you got to stop this. Like, I'm trying to forget about it. You need to get over it. And it was like, I was trying to, but it just kept on coming back. But I feel like I've worked a lot, like, mentally. I feel like my biggest problem in that fight was mentally. I feel like I won the first round, but I was shutting down mentally the whole time. And I've worked a lot with meditating, visualizing, things like that. And I feel like I've really built myself as a stronger fighter there. I've prepared myself these last two fights a lot more than I did. And I feel like, I don't know, I underestimated her a little bit going into that fight too. And it just kind of showed me that all these girls are tough. No matter what in the UFC, all these girls are going to give you a fight. They're going to be hard matchups.
I feel like you're the kind of person who would prefer to lose a decision or via TKO or KO than be submitted. Like tapping is maybe what bothers you the most. Is that fair?
The only time I've ever got TKO'd was in the, I feel like just getting finished in general. Okay. Like most of my losses are decisions. The only finishes that I have are against Barb Honchak in the house. And then this one too. So it's like all my other losses are decisions. So this one, that I feel like that's why they hurt the most.
All right. So now that you're on this roll, like I feel, you know, 125 is relatively shallow these days. We've got the champion Valentina Shevchenko fighting in less than 2 weeks against Liz Carmouche in a rematch, but there's not a lot going on there. How far away do you think you are from being in that discussion?
I'd say about a year or two still. I feel like you said, the division is pretty shallow. I feel like Valentina doesn't have a lot of competition right now. So I'm probably going to get moved up fast. And when that opportunity comes, I'll be ready for it.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about, you know, being in a, you know, maybe shallow division. You get pushed a lot sooner. Do you want to be on that fast track or would you prefer to take your time? You know, like you have some divisions where you got a guy like Tony Ferguson who's winning 13 fights in a row and can't sniff a title shot. And then you have other weight classes where you win two in a row and you're in the title picture. What would you prefer?
I just love to fight. I'm here to work my way up there. If they're going to offer me it sooner, then like I said, I'll be ready for it. But no matter what, I'm willing to do whatever the UFC wants for me. I'm willing to fight four times a year till I get to that spot. You know, I just love what I do.
When you see Valentina fight, do you feel like you're close to her level or do you think you need more time?
I definitely feel like I need more time at this moment. I feel like she's it's not it's not a winnable fight for me at this moment. I feel like I have potential to take out any girl in this division. I feel like the way my submission grappling is set up, the way I attack my submissions is unique, and a lot of people don't necessarily know how to defend it. So I feel like I would take that fight. I have potential to finish it, but if I had the opportunity to wait a couple years, still develop myself a little bit more, I feel like I'd be better there.
I asked Paige VanZant about her recently, and she said that when she watched her, she feels like she's a frightening fighter. Like she is just a scary individual. Do you feel the same? Do you feel like she has that intimidation?
I don't necessarily think so. I'm not scared of anybody. I feel like the girl that I fought this last weekend, she has that intimidation factor to a lot of people. Everybody's like, oh, just by her appearance, she looks like she can fight. But that doesn't mean anything to me. I'll out-technique anybody any day.
Yeah, she does. I mean, we're looking at a picture of her. She's got the tattoos on her head. She got right up in your face at the ceremonial weigh-ins. Do you feel like she was trying to intimidate you prior to the fight?
I think that's a little bit part of just her tactics, you know, try to get in my head a little bit, just try to, I don't know. It doesn't faze me in any way though. So it's like, I don't even think about it.
Why do they call you Savage?
So after my first MMA fight, Dean wrote a letter about me to my whole MMA team. And he was like, she's as quiet as a mouse, but when she walks into the cage, she turns into a savage. And then one of my friends was like, oh, you hear that? And then it just kind of cut on after that.
So he wrote a letter to the team?
It was an email.
Okay.
He had like group chat email. It was way back in the day, like 5-6 years ago.
Okay. Maybe before like group texts were a thing. It's group email.
Yeah, probably.
And so he was pumping you up. He was telling everyone about how well you did.
Yeah, he was just telling everybody about how well I had my first amateur fight in Tallahassee. And it was actually before I knew any jujitsu at all. And I went and I was just like a straight cardio kickboxer kind of. And we went 3 rounds and it went to a decision. I won my first amateur fight. But that's when I got the nickname right after that.
Wow. And you're around a lot of great women at ATT. Amanda Nunes, the champion, Joanna Jacek, Nina Ansaroff. Do you train a lot with these women or are you someone who trains more with the guys?
I train with both guys and girls. I feel like there's benefits to both. It's like, as you saw this weekend with Sarah Froda, she just moves different. Like, girls can move different. They're flexible as anything. So it's like, me training with guys, they'll be more explosive, maybe a little bit more technical, and definitely faster. But girls just, they move a different way that guys can't really offer. So it's, I feel like when I start training with guys more, then girls will give me more problems just doing weird things. Like, with Sarah this weekend, like, her foot would come out of nowhere. I'm like, how did that get there? Like, she was just so long and lanky and flexible. It was just difficult to deal with.
Dean is also the head coach for Greg Hardy, who has, you know, drawn a lot of criticism because of his past. Do you have any issues with being in the gym with him, being a teammate of his?
Oh, no. Greg Hardy is one of the nicest people I know. Like, I obviously, like you said, past criticism, whatever. I don't judge him off that. And he's really one of the nicest people, like, to be around. Anytime he comments on one of my posts, it gets on my nerves whenever people start commenting back. I'm like, there's just no need for that. Obviously, he might have made a mistake. He might have not. Whatever happened in the past is the past. And he's trying to make himself a better person from it now. And he's, like I said, he's one of the nicest people I know.
Do you want to return on that Vancouver card as well? Do you want to fight in Canada again?
Oh, that would be absolutely amazing. I would love a quick turnaround like that too. I just want to get back in there as fast as possible. I'm really open for anything, anytime.
Anyone on your mind?
Not at the moment right now. I feel like I'm not sure what the UFC wants for me. So I'm down for whatever they want to, whatever path they want to take me. If they're trying to push me faster, get me somewhat ranked, or if they just want to get me another fight, whatever it is, I'm just happy to be in there and happy to do this job.
All right. Well, keep on smiling, Jillian. It's great to have you on the show for the first time. Congratulations on all your success. And also, keep representing Canada the way you do. Well done. We'll let you, we'll let you be a dual citizen, but we're going to own you because we don't have a lot to own these days in Canadian MMA. So you're part of that new breed and you're doing great things. So keep it up.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And say hello to Robin for us.
Of course.
All right. There she is, Jillian Robertson, a.k.a. Savage, doing her thing. 2-fight win streak, both via stoppage. Only lost once in the UFC, 4-1 in the UFC. And she's got wonderful hair as well. Also wonderful, by the way, as you look at some of her news. I wanted to give it. Okay, let me do this, and I'll get to what was wonderful on the back end. Let me tell you about our good friends over at Lightstream. Are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Are you ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream with rates as low as 5.95% APR with autopay. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees, no application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, no prepayment penalties. The rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, you can even get your money in your bank account as soon as the day you apply. The online application is so easy. You can apply right from your phone. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. So now, just for our listeners and viewers, apply to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/Ariel. That's LIGHTSTREAM. .com/Ariel. That's me, A-R-I-E-L. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.50% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/Ariel for more information. I wanted to tell you some very exciting news for the Helwani family. My lovely sister, my kid's sister, is a mother. She gave birth Saturday night right after the main event. It's a great moment for my family. We're all very happy. We're all very excited about her being a mom. Nice little baby girl, Liv. It's a great thing. Going to Montreal tomorrow to be with the family. So I just wanted to say Mazel Tov to my sister and Mike. Love them very much. And I just wanted to wish them all the best as they embark on this new venture known as parenthood. So we're very happy in the Helwani family, and we're happy to be doing this show today and happy to say hello to our next guest. It was announced on Friday that he will, in fact, be fighting BJ Penn later this year. They've had maybe an issue over the years, and it's actually going to play out. I think this caught a lot of people by surprise. They didn't think that BJ would get another fight in the UFC, but here we are. He is getting another fight, and he's fighting Nick the Carney Lentz. And so let us say hello now to Nick Lentz, who joins us via the Magic Skype. Nick, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it very much. So this kind of came out of nowhere. I think most people didn't think BJ would get another fight. And I don't know if the fan base is happy about it. But first, let me ask you, when did you find out that this was something that the UFC wanted to do?
Well, you know, BJ comes on my Instagram like every couple months or something, talking crap and stuff. And so I noticed like the other day he came on there you know, talking about how he would see me soon or something. And I thought it was like a joke, you know. I was like, where are you going to see me? You know, I don't spend time in the back of Hawaiian police cars. There's no chance you're going to see me, you know. So I just told, I just assumed that he, I was pretty much done with him. And then the UFC reached out to me and asked if I wanted to fight him. And, you know, I've been saying this for years, that I was going to, at 155 pounds, kick BJ Penn's ass, and that's what I'm going
to
do.
Wow. So he would actually go on your Instagram and write comments from time to time, like troll you, like try to pick fights with you. What would he write?
Oh, I mean, nonstop. Every couple of months, he would like send me direct messages, you know, threatening me, threatening my family, just doing all kinds of stuff. The guy's a whack job. And he's been allowed to just be this bad person his entire life because he was good at something, you know? That's just how it is in America. It's like, if you're good at fighting or you're good at sports or you can catch a ball, you can be as much of a dirtbag as you want. And so he comes on my Instagram all the time. He even, when I don't respond to him, he goes to my wife's Instagram to say, hey, tell your husband to respond to me on my Instagram.
What?
Like, it's ridiculous.
He's, really?
Yeah. I'm not. The guy is 100% obsessed with me.
Wow.
So he's always, so, but every time, like, we were going to fight in the past, like I said, you know, let's fight. He would never sign the contract. He only would talk. And now finally, I guess, I don't know why all of a sudden he's decided, maybe he came down off some coke binge or something, and he decided now's the time that we're going to actually accept it. So, you know, no fight is scheduled yet. I've accepted the fight. I guess he's verbally accepted as well. I'm just waiting on the date from the UFC.
When did they reach out to you about this? Last week?
Yeah, last week. You know, I mean, I had talked to the UFC previously about going back to 145 pounds. That's always been the goal, to stay at 55 long enough so I could get my body back to where I wanted to do and then make my final run at 145 pounds. So they called me and said, hey, Nick, would you be interested in this? And I said, yeah, but I just want to stay at 145 pounds. And they said, well, BJ won't fight at 145 pounds, which I said he should never do in the first place. I'm the only person who's ever cared about BJ. Everyone else just throws him to the wolves. Everyone else just like, oh, he's such a legend, you know, but I'm the only person who actually gave him a dose of reality. I said, no, you're not a legend. You're a dirtbag. You're a drug addict. You don't take care of your family. You don't take care of your fans. You do nothing good for nobody, and you need to get your shit together. But the media and everyone has just dragged him along and gave him this confidence that it doesn't matter what innocent person he beats up. It doesn't matter if he goes to the strip club and is mean to women and they kick him out. So then he beats up the bouncers and he has his little handlers that save him and stuff, you know? It's ridiculous. So the second the UFC reached out to me, I think they reached out to me on Saturday and said, you know, like, hey, would you be interested in this? And I said, yeah, of course I'd be interested in this. I told you guys were going to be calling me. I knew I would be the guy to take BJ out, to actually retire him. And after I beat him, then he will actually be done. I promise you that.
And just curious, did you find out about this after Dana White said it to the media, or did you know beforehand?
No, Dana didn't say anything until like it was pretty crazy. Like the millisecond I said, like, okay, like the Dana thing popped up. So, I mean, I guess Sean reached out to Dana right away and said, yeah, you know, Lens is down and he'll go up to 145 pounds for this last fight. And I guess he'll, you know, who knows how he got the fight? Who knows how much he annoyed, you know? Him and Dana have a dysfunctional relationship. The whole UFC has a dysfunctional relationship with BJ. So I guess he gets what he wants. I guess he can just be as bad of a person or do whatever he wants and just, you know. I mean, if I did or if anyone else in the UFC did one-tenth of what BJ did, they would never have a job again. In all of MMA, much less the UFC.
Okay, so let's start from the beginning for those that may not know. When did you first meet BJ Penn?
I don't remember the year at this point. I mean, it was like 5 years ago, 6 years ago or something.
Okay.
He asked me to come out to one of his training things, so I went out to Hawaii and I met him there.
So he invited you to be a training partner?
Yeah, they flew me out there, paid me some money to help him out.
Okay, and was that through Mike Dolce?
I mean, yeah, probably. I'm not totally sure how that all got together.
Okay, and when you were out there, were you guys cool, or was it apparent from the get-go that you just couldn't get along?
No, we were cool. What I wasn't cool with is when I got there, like, not to go into too much history, but the way I grew up and the place that, like, where I've been in life, I can spot a drug addict. I can see it. I can spot someone who's not in a good place. And when I went out there originally, I thought, like, well, this is BJ Penn, you know, like I don't know him personally, but I was thinking we'd be training in, like, a good facility. I was thinking he would be working very hard. But I'm not even joking. He actually, when I met him, he had a bum that followed him around, and that was like his little guy to take care of him. Like, he had a literal bum that followed him around. So I was like, this is BJ, and this is what we're gonna do. We're gonna train 30 minutes a day, and I'm gonna sit here in Hawaii in a little room, and you know, there was no internet, there was no nothing. Like, it was like, no, I'm not doing this. I'm going to go home.
Wow.
So I got there. I said, you know, hey, guys, you know, this isn't for me. This isn't for me. This isn't what I was expecting. I was expecting, like, a real training camp. You know, I got stuff to prepare for. You know, you guys can keep your money or whatever. They asked me to stay a couple more days. I stayed a couple more days. They paid me. I went home.
Wow. How long were you there for? Approximately?
Three, 4 days.
Okay. And did you actually get paid?
Oh, I got paid some of it, not all of it, not what I was supposed to, but I got paid some of it.
Okay. And so does this all stem from that? Like, is he mad that you left or said the things that you said? Is that really the impetus of all of this?
No, who knows, you know, like I left and then shortly after he challenged me to a fight. Like, as far as I was concerned, like, we were good. You know what I mean? Like, I left and I was just like, hey guys, like, this just isn't for me. Right? Like, sometimes you go somewhere and, like, if I brought someone out and I said, hey, you know, you're going to come train with me or whatever, they got here and they're like, you know what, Nick, I just don't like training here. I don't like the hotel I'm staying at. You know, I'm just going to go home. I would be fine with that. But then suddenly I guess it rubbed them the wrong way. And then, like, a couple weeks later, I woke up in the morning and, like, I had actually just had, like, knee surgery, and I wake up and my phone had, like, I had, like, a million messages, you know, from you, from all kinds of people saying, like, are you going to fight BJ? And I'm like, what? Why would I fight BJ? I don't even, like, what are you guys talking about? And then I had to go search online and see that he was challenging me to fights, that he was saying all these bad things about me. And so, yeah, it's ridiculous, you know? It's ridiculous. The guy's a nut job. And not only is he a nut job, he's obsessed with me. So.
And so, throughout the years, like, he's had a lot of fights, and I remember us saying, like, oh, this would be this is, you know, at the beginning of this losing streak and all that. He hasn't won a fight since 2010. We said, like, oh, this would be the perfect time for Nick and BJ to fight. These days, I don't think people were really talking about it because I think we all thought that he was done. Why didn't it ever happen in the past?
Because he would never sign the paper.
Okay, so they would offer it as far as your understanding. Okay.
Yeah, they would offer him the fight. And then he would come up with some excuse as to why he wouldn't do it. I always said, hey, there's an open invitation. You know, if you send me a paper with BJ Penn's name on it, you can just assume that it's signed.
Okay.
And they sent me the papers, and they kept getting signed, and yet he never signed. That's where we are.
Have you ever had a face-to-face conversation, you know, with him since you left Hawaii and all this kind of fell apart? Have you ever seen him anywhere?
No. No, why would I have a conversation with him? He goes on my Instagram and, like, threatens me. And not only threatens me, he's like, I'm going to kill you if I see you. I'm going to do this. If I saw BJ Penn, I'll freaking slap him. That's what I would do. I have no interest in talking to him.
Why don't you just block him on social media?
Because I think, because there's a side of me that there's two sides. There's a side of me that thinks it's funny. And then there's a side of me that, like, feels bad for the guy, because I really think that the media and people have allowed BJ Penn to push himself to the edge. Mm. And that very soon he's going to end up in a bad situation. He's going to OD. He's going to kill himself. He's going to do something. And at least, you know, at some point, like, I feel bad cutting the guy off, because I'll be like the last freaking person on earth that cuts him off. This whole time, like I said, I'm the only one who's actually cared about him, who's actually said, hey, bro, you're messing up your life. You are fucking up. You need to fix it. You need to get it together. but everyone else just talks about how much of a legend he is and how he can do no wrong and that everything that he does is okay. And it's not. And it's ruining his life. And eventually he's going to end up either dead or in a mental hospital eating applesauce out of a straw.
And so you actually say this to him? You actually write this back to him when he writes things to you?
No, I don't write that much back to him. I just leave it open. And I just, but I'm telling him that now.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I'm like, what's wrong with you? You know, when he sends up to me, I just make fun of him online. But when it's the private messages and stuff, it's a little more personal. And I just leave it alone. You know, I posted it a while back. Like a couple years back, I posted some of it. I mean, it's ridiculous.
So you mentioned the fans and you mentioned the media, and I do believe to a degree you are correct. But what about the UFC? This man hasn't won since 2010. Eight fights in a row he hasn't won. Why are they giving him a fight? Don't you feel like they need to stop giving him fights as well?
Well, I think it's too late for people to care about BJ. Like, I really do. Like, I think at this point, like it's kind of ridiculous. It's like you walk past the guy and you see him like digging his own grave, and every day you walk to him and you give him a drink of water and say good job, and you pat him on the back, and then the next day he's digging his own grave, and you walk past him, you give him some water, you say good job, legend, you're doing a great job, and then you give him some more water, and now all of a sudden everyone's worried about him, like, oh, he's taking 18 million strikes to the head or whatever, you know, like. Like, I just can't wrap my head around the idea that suddenly people care about BJ's health when the whole time they've been kissing his ass and allowing him to do crazy things like to destroy his body with drugs, to get in fights outside of the UFC, to have domestic violence issues, to do all these things. And they just always look past and they say, oh, man, you're such a good guy, BJ. Everything is good. And now suddenly now. Now it's just too much, you know. The first fight, the first five fights, kid, that wasn't enough. The six fights, kid, seven, eight, you know, the guy hasn't won a fight since we went to war in Iraq. I mean, it's ridiculous. But I'm going to end his career, and I'm going to do him a favor.
And so you have the situation, and all the things that you're saying, you know, there's obviously truth to it. But you have a situation where, like Dana White has said, Chuck Liddell should retire. Big Nog should retire. We don't want to be in business. We don't want to promote these fights anymore. And he did say this once about Penn after the Edgar fight, the third fight. And then he said it after the last one too, like, I can't do this anymore. And so is there a part of you that's like, how does this make any sense? Like, when you got this call, were you like, really? BJ Penn? I think we all thought that they were not going to promote his fights anymore.
But that's not up to me. You know, it's not up to me. Like, I don't care about BJ's health when it comes to winning a fight. And when they offer me the fight, I'm going to train like I'm fighting for the title. I'm going to hurt this guy. And I'm going to work as hard as I possibly can and train at the top of my level and do everything I possibly can to end his career and to do him a favor. And so, no, like when they call me, I don't think like, oh, you know, poor BJ, you know, whatever. I fight for money. I'm a prize fighter.
Right.
And I want to take care of my family. And so whoever they send me, I'm fighting.
That's fair. That's totally fair. Do you know when this fight is going to happen?
No, I don't know. I gave them the Aspen was the earliest fight I could fight. I gave them the date that I could fight. And then I'm waiting to see what card they put us on.
What date is that? Could you tell us that?
I said the end of September because I just bought a house. We're moving in at the end of August into early September. So, you know, I'm going to spend some time with my family. We're going to get all moved over there. I'm going to take my girls and my wife to the new house. We'll get settled and then we'll be training for the fight.
Okay.
So I can't do it before that.
Sure.
Then
sure.
We'll go end of September into October, probably. You know, I'd prefer October, but we'll see end of September.
But it is going to happen in 2019, as far as you're concerned.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely in 2019. I mean, I want to fight before the end of the year, so.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely.
And Dana White said that win, lose, or draw, this is it for BJ Penn. Do you relish the opportunity to be the last man to fight him, to be the one to, quote-unquote, end his career? Is this like a gift for you?
Well, I don't look at anything as a gift. You know, I still have to go out there and beat them up. And I'm going to. So I'm not gonna overlook this thing, you know. I'm not gonna overlook it. And if you think like I'm not gonna be one of these guys that just like, oh, you know, like I mean, I'm going to win this fight. I'm 10 times better than BJ Penn. I'm going to win, but I'm gonna be ready. And he's gonna face the best Nick Lentz there's ever been.
Have you ever felt this way about an opponent before? Clearly this is personal. The DMs, all that stuff, the history. Have you ever felt this way about an opponent going into a fight?
Well, now it's different. I mean, maybe a couple of years, when this originally started, like then my blood was like actually boiling when this stuff started. Like then I was actually kind of mad, and then that would have been different. But now everything it's just confirmation. You know, I've been saying this stuff for years, like I'm a science fiction writer or something. You know, like I mapped out everything that's going to happen in BJ's life. I told everyone the spiral he was going down. I've been saying this for years, and everyone is like, everyone treated me like I was some kind of nutcase. Like, how dare you say BJ Penn isn't the best thing that ever walked the earth? How dare you say these bad things about him? How dare you say he's going to end up in a mental hospital? How dare you say he's going to get arrested? How dare you say he's going to be a domestic violence person? How dare you say he's a drug addict? And look what happened. Everything I said is true. And so the only issue I have, like that actually still gets to me is that like when this originally happened, I like sort of got blacklisted by the media. I got blacklisted by people as being like, who the fuck is Nick Lentz and why is he allowed to talk crap about BJ? And because I'm the only person that ever said the truth. And now I don't know, maybe it's divine justice or whatever, but I'm the only person that if they give me the fight and it ends up happening, you know, I'm still questioning. I don't know if he's going to sign it or not. He's always a talker. You know, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But if he signs it, yeah, I'll be happy to retire him.
So considering he is so beloved and you've had this public feud with him, you've gotten hate from his fans as well for saying these things?
Well, I've not only gotten hate from the fans, I've gotten hate, massive hate from the media.
Really?
Yeah, tons. When this beef originally started, I mean, I got so much hate, so many MMA writers, all that stuff just wrote terrible things about me, about my family, about all kinds of stuff. Like how dare Nick Lentz say anything? You know, he doesn't deserve the right to do anything. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I don't really know what else to say about that.
Okay. Any more poems coming out about him? You once did that.
Yeah. Again, I did that. I did that and I might do it again. I might do it again. But the reason I did that is because it's a way to mess with fighters that they don't understand, right? They want you to be like upset. Like, no, you're not going to kick my ass. I'm going to kick your ass. But then when you belittle them and you make fun of them and you attack their intelligence, it frustrates them. And that's probably one of the reasons why to this day, which is ridiculous, that he still comes on my Instagram and talks crap to me. You know, it bugged him. It bugged him immensely. More than I could have imagined.
When you prepare for BJ, are you preparing, like, will you look at the old BJ or are you going to look at, you know, the recent BJ? It's almost like two different people, two different fighters. How do you prepare for this guy?
Well, no, I mean, you got to prepare for what you see, you know, like if you prepare for the old BJ, you might get caught with something sloppy, you know, like I got to prepare for what I've seen in his last fights. We'll watch his fights. We'll be ready. You know, I have the best coaches in the world. I got Henry Hoof, Kami, you know, Greg, you know, we have one of the best teams at Hard Knocks. So yeah, I mean, I'll be 1,000,000% ready for the fight.
Okay. And I understand what you are saying. I guess it's almost a silly question to ask, but like to see this guy who meant so much to so many people in the sport, to see what's happened to him now, both in and out of the cage. I'm assuming there's no part of you that feels bad for him, right? That has any remorse or feels like it's kind of a shame to see what's happened to a guy who helped build the sport.
No, I disagree with that. I think I'm the only person that's actually felt bad for him. You know what I mean? Like I feel like everyone else has just been an enabler because they didn't want to deal with reality. Because when they got into MMA so many years ago, like that was one of the guys that like got him into MMA or whatever reason it is. they want to look back at their past and they want to think fondly of it, which, you know, is ridiculous. You know, I truly feel I'm the only person who has given a crap about BJ because I was willing to look at him and say, hey, bro, you're a mess and you need to fix yourself. While everyone else was just patting him on the back and let him just continue down the destructive path he's on.
Hmm. Is a decision victory not enough? Do you want to finish him? Do you want to actually get a TKO or submission over him?
I mean, it might be more fun to beat him up 15 minutes versus finish it quick, but no, I'll take the victory however it comes.
Okay. Well, I think we'll leave it at that. Nick, I appreciate it. Thank you very much for coming on the show and good luck in the fight.
Thank you so much. Congratulations to your sister, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Congrats on the house. Appreciate that, Nick. There he is. Yep. Nick the Carney Lentz. He will meet BJ Penn later this year. I like the lighting. I don't know if he did that on purpose or whatnot, but it just kind of fit the whole mood of the interview. As you can see, there's a history there. As you can see, there are some feelings there. This dates back many years. You can see it all there on the internet. And it came as a surprise, not the biggest surprise. Like I said, I'm sort of numb to the BJ Penn story at this point. 8 fights in a row. He has not won. 7 losses in a row. And he just had that fight against Clay Guida, and he just doesn't look like himself. And, you know, he's getting into issues. He's getting into trouble outside of the cage. And we don't know about what's going on. I've said this story before where I saw him the weekend of his Hall of Fame induction, and it seemed like he was having a good time in Vegas. It seemed like he was, you know, loving life. You understand what I'm saying. And I said to him, congratulations on being inducted into the Hall of Fame. And he said, I'm not a Hall of Famer. I'm not retired. You know, it seemed like he just didn't know how to react to that. And this is a guy who's, you know, for the majority of his life, who was shaped by being a mixed martial artist, a BJJ practitioner. He was the prodigy. He was this phenom. And it seems like he's having a lot of trouble dealing with life after fighting. And so there's a thought process out there that, hey, if he's training for a fight, if he's gunning for a date, if he's got some structure in his life, that's good. That's ultimately a lot healthier than sitting on the couch and just passing time. But that's a good thing to say if you're like, oh, you know, you got a job and you're focused on your job. No, you're gunning for a fight where people are punching you, kicking you. Like, you could get really hurt. And so I don't understand how we could advocate, how the UFC can advocate, how Dana White can advocate for the retirement of Chuck Liddell, the retirement of Big Nog and other people, and we keep trotting this guy out there, a legend. I talked to someone this weekend who said to me, like, oh, BJ Penn, this guy, like spoke about him like he's a scrub. Like, he has no business being in the cage. Like, a total non-factor of a fighter. That's the way they spoke about him. There was a time back in 2009 where I was sitting there watching him fight. I've told the story before, against Diego Sanchez, UFC 107, Memphis, Tennessee, and I was looking at the best fighter on the planet, the absolute best fighter on the planet. And there is a part of me that feels like all the stuff that's going on outside of the cage has something to do with the stuff that's going on in the cage. I don't feel like he should be fighting. And I feel like it is negligent at this point to put him in the cage fighting other people who do not like him, who are going to try to hurt him. I'm not trying to protect him. I'm not trying to coddle him. I'm not trying to, you know, he's not a baby. It's not someone that we cradle. It's not someone that, he's a grown man. But it's very clear that he's not the same fighter. He's losing every time, and it's not even close. Why are we doing this? Because he terrorized you? It's a cage fight. And like we could say, mind your business. You're not a, no, this is my business. My business is to talk about fighting. I talk about fighting for a living. It's actually quite literally my business to talk about things like this. This man should not be fighting. And this man should not be in a cage, whether it's Bellator, UFC, Ryzen, One, should not be fighting. Now, if you feel indebted to him, get him on the payroll like you did with Chuck and Big Nog. Do something like that. But how you can justify putting him in the cage against someone who clearly doesn't like him, to me is something that I just can't wrap my head around. I can't wrap my head around it. It's sad to watch. especially after we saw what happened last week. And that was a 28-year-old young man who was undefeated. A healthy boxer who had not taken the blows that BJ Penn has taken over the course of his career. How do you justify this? I'm not trying to start a fight. I'm not trying to antagonize anyone. Look at the numbers. Look at the amount of punches he's taking. Look at the damage he's taking. Look at the losses on the resume. How do you justify this? How does it make sense? It should have ended a long time ago. And yeah, he's hurting his legacy. Of course, there's people right now who only started watching fighting in like 2014, 15, who don't know BJ Penn. One of the greatest ever. Did unbelievable things at 155, at 170, went all the way up to 205 to fight Lyoto Machida. People don't know these things about him because of what he's doing now, because of the situation that he's in. Things might not be good at home. Doesn't mean you put him in a cage. Or at the very least, in the UFC, shouldn't be doing that. I'm sorry. It should not happen. It's uncomfortable to watch. It's not safe. It's not right. And you can say all you want about win, lose, or draw. This is the last one. Says who? We thought that about the last one. You don't have to be a doctor to realize this isn't right. This shouldn't be happening. So it's disappointing. But hey, Nick Lentz is going to take the fight and I don't begrudge him for that. I mean, he's being offered a fight. He's got to feed his family. I just feel like this type of stuff shouldn't be happening. Well, that's the story on that fight. And we'll see when the date is, when it actually happens. So let's go from that. That's a little dark and depressing and disappointing to something that I'm very excited about. I've been trying to get this man on this program for like 2 years and he keeps eluding me, but there he is. Hollywood star himself, Freddie Prinze Jr. on the program. This is great. Freddie, how are you?
Good, man. Good. I'm glad to finally be on your show. You've been so kind as to come to ESPN Los Angeles and do our radio show out there when I fill in from time to time. It's the only time they allow us to talk MMA. So thank you.
Yes, it's great to have you on. And you're just what the doctor ordered for us because we just went from the Nick Lentz, BJ Penn story to, you know, talking to you. So this is great. Like your smiling face is like medicine for my heart. It's great to have you here. So, first let me ask, did you watch UFC 240?
I did watch UFC 240. I liked two of the fights.
Okay.
but I think it's been, they've had some good pay-per-views lately, so it, you know, to live up to the last couple as far as the amount of knockouts that have been going on was going to be very, very tough. But I don't know the young man's name who had those amazing knees against the Asian kid and then put him down with the left kick. But I loved him, and I love watching Max Holloway fight.
Of course. That's Hakeem Dawoodu, who we had on the show earlier today of Canada. So he's a rising star. He had a great win over Yoshinori Horie. And it's important to know that you are watching all these cards. Like, 240 might be one that people are skipping. You know, 239 was great. 241 is going to be great. There was Pacquiao the week before. But you go out of your way to watch. Is there one guy in particular? You're a hardcore fan. Like, let's make no mistake about this. You're a hardcore fan. Is there one guy in particular that you say, okay, no matter when, no matter how, I have to watch this guy? Who's your favorite right now?
Yeah, that's Tony Ferguson. That's super, super easy, man. The guy trains differently than anyone I've ever seen train. And I grew up with some of the best martial artists in the world since I was 3 years old. So I know when I see someone almost creating a new martial art. I mean, I grew up with Bob Wall. If you don't know who that is, I'm not going to Jalen Rose you and say, Google it. I'll tell you who that is.
Please.
That's the man that when Bruce Lee came to this country, that's the man that Bruce sought out and my godfather sought him out, so that they could train together. And that group of Bob Wall, Chuck Norris, that whole team there, those were the men that raised me. My dad was famous back in the 70s, killed himself. And because of that, a lot of the people he charmed vowed to never let that happen to me. So when I watch Tony train, it's like seeing, I mean, I call Gene LaBelle Uncle Gene. You know, like I call, remember the referee from Karate Kid with the mustache? The
yes.
Original one. He's like, are you all right, LaRusso? That's Pat, Uncle Pat. He's not my uncle, but I called him Uncle Pat. He taught me how to throw a sidekick when I was 5 years old. Like,
wow.
So those are the guys I grew up with here in Southern California. And when I got the chance to meet Tony, I texted him. I sent him a message on social media. I was like, hey man, let me roll with you. And he wrote back, are you crazy? And I wrote back, well, I don't know, but let me roll with you, please. And so he was like, yeah, man, if you're willing to come down to Costa Mesa. So I went down to that old RCVD gym that he used to work out of or whatever that company was called, and showed him what I could do. And then he put it on me. And then he gave me a nice light workout after that. And I had a great experience. But watching the way he approached, this was before he was a black belt in jiu-jitsu. Seeing how he approached philosophies in jiu-jitsu that don't go against anything you've learned, but are almost, I don't even know how to explain it because I'm not as good as him and not as creative as him. But he finds new ways to get to his most dominant positions that my body just can't do. Maybe it's because his arms are as long as, you know, a set of janitor's mops, or maybe it's because he's just that much better than everyone else. But that guy blew my mind. So he's the one I watch no matter what. I love T-City. That guy got me my blue belt.
Wow.
5 or 6 years ago. Yeah, man. Like, my instructor at the Gracie Academy blew out his knee, and Brian was a brown belt then. And he took over and was kind enough. That's Alex Stewart right there. That's my man, United States Marine Corps. It's my master right there. But when he hurt his knee, his buddy Brian, who I didn't really know about then, UFC hadn't signed him yet, he was like, oh, man, I'll take over. I'll help you. And Brian's jiu-jitsu is just stupid. Like, I've never rolled with anything like that in my life. But he helped me get my blue belt, and I'm forever grateful for that.
Wow. So you got real street cred. I mean, like you said, 3 years old, you've been doing this. This is amazing. And not just in the acting world, but in our world as well. So Bob Wall was your godfather.
Yeah, man. He taught my dad how to fight. One of my dad's best friends was Muhammad Ali. Wow. And Ali used to always, my dad loved to box. He grew up in New York City, boxed, but wasn't very good. And Ali used to just beat his ass, just pepper him, ting, 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 and bust his face up. My dad got sick of it. He knew Bob Wall was the Hollywood guru that was teaching Steve McQueen, James Garner, all these old school actors who weren't tough, trying to teach them how to look tough. And so my dad started training with him. My dad was 6'2" and a half. He was a big guy. And my godfather taught him the check hook, the left hook. And so Ali and my dad, this is the craziest story. Ali and my dad are sparring at Ali's house, and they're messing around in the living room. And my dad catches him with a left hook. And Ali's like right in front of the couch. So he kind of like stumbles backwards on the couch and he gets a bloody nose. My dad hauls ass to the bathroom, grabs the towel, comes in, wipes the blood off Ali's face, runs out of his house, jumps in his 76 Corvette Stingray, hauls ass back to Woodrow Wilson Drive top of the valley in the hills right there, and framed the towel, framed the towel. Ali would call the house and scare my poor mother and be like, you tell that boy I'm going to kill him. Tell him I'm going to kill him. He's a dead man. He would literally scare my – we still have the towel. I ask my mom for it all the time. She says, you can have it when I'm dead. But it's literally framed like a war medal on wow. purple crushed velvet. And it says Ali's blood. I think the date is June 16th, 1970 – or 75. He had a 75 Stingray. So it was June 16th, 1975.
Wow. Did you ever hang out with Ali?
I got to meet him once as a boy, but never at like the level I got to hang out with like the Bob Walls and the Chuck Norrises. Chuck broke my rib when I was like 14 years old because I thought I was hot shit and won a karate tournament here in Southern California. I had good hands, right? And back then, a lot of Taekwondo guys didn't have good hands. So I would just get inside, score, do my business there. Thought I was cool. You know, testosterone going. Yes. Puberty just finished. I was a late bloomer. And feeling myself. And we were in Tarzana, California, and my godfather and Chuck were like, Chuck, this was before Walker, Texas Ranger, before he took all the Machado brothers to Houston, Texas, and started making that show. He lived here in California. My godfather took me over there, and he had this cool little room that he would spar legends in. I mean, legends. That's where the Machados first whipped Chuck's ass and got him into jiu-jitsu. So I'm on the same wood as these guys were. And I threw out my jab, which was so nice. And he threw a round kick nicely. And it hit me in that, call it the floating rib. It's your bottom one. It feels a little softer than the rest. And I dropped like a stone. My godfather's laughing because anytime I got cocky, he would always make me humbled by someone. Uncle Pat had this, or Uncle Gene had this student named Gokor, I think, and he had just given him his own school in the late 80s. He had him whip my ass one time. Like, they always would humble me. So he catches me. I drop. They just thought they knocked the wind out of me. He wasn't trying to hurt me. He was just trying to sting me a little bit. And they get me home. I'm still hurting bad. And my godmother, Lillian, Bob's wife, God bless her, knew I was really hurt, freaked out. She's like, we can't tell Kathy. She'll get a gun and shoot you. And she would have. My mom was no joke. But those were like, those were the dudes that raised me because I didn't have, you know, I didn't have a pops. So those were all the guys that had daughters or didn't. Chuck had sons, but he was always good to me too. But the rest of all those tough guys, they all just had daughters. So they loved having this boy who was always kind of like a sponge looking for a dad, which I was. And those men were kind enough to share their time and those lessons with me, man.
Wow. This is phenomenal stuff. These are great stories. and you also trained with the great Jean-Jacques Machado, right? Back in the day?
He was the very first jiu-jitsu instructor I ever had.
Wow.
This was another one of those moments my godfather thought would be a teaching moment. I was wrestling and I was good for a kid, you know, but still good. And it was the year after the Dodgers won the World Series, I think. So I think it was 89 or 90. And he had a school in Tarzana, California, at a place called the Wall Street Village, which was a shopping center my godfather owned. And he was on the second floor, all glass windows. And we go up. And I didn't even know what jiu-jitsu was, okay? Like, I never even heard of it. I heard of ninjutsu from, like, you know, the Batman cartoon and stuff. But that was it. And so we go in there, and I see this dude. And he's got one hand. And I'm looking at him, and I'm looking at my godfather like, what? Man, I'm going to murk this guy. What are you talking about? And I don't even want to, like, get in there with him because I'm feeling good about myself, right? And then forget jiu-jitsu. He, first of all, put me in a fireman's carry, which is a wrestling hold. If you get caught in, sucks. If you wrestle and they don't. In, like, 2 seconds, had me on his shoulders, spun me around like a pro wrestler and is going, which window, little junior, which window? They all call me Junior. And, I literally was like Chris Tucker in what's the Jackie Chan movie where he's like, which one of y'all just kicked me? Like,
Rush Hour.
I didn't know what happened. Rush Hour. Thank you. And then I was addicted to it. And the first thing he taught me was escaping the mount. And the second thing he taught me was the Americana. And I got kicked out of the seventh grade about 3 weeks after.
Wow.
it was experimenting.
Wow. Okay. So you clearly martial arts in your blood. You're around martial artists, legends, like you say. Did you ever consider actually becoming a prize fighter?
I mean, I had the fantasies like everyone else does, but even my fantasies required supernatural gifts for me to like execute them, right? So it would be like I would have to summon the spirit of Bruce Lee in order to win the damn fight. But I, you know, as an amateur, I enjoyed it. But I'm a sweet boy, man. I'm not trying to go in there and have that kind of courage. I mean, I have dad courage. That's as far as it goes. Like, you mess with my family, then it's a problem. As far as getting in a cage where they lock the gate and the only way out is if you lose or win, that's next level stuff, man. It's funny. All these actors now are wanting to get in the cage. I pitched the Out of Work Actors Fight League to Dana White 2 years ago, 2 years ago. And if you use an acronym, it does sound awful. And yes, that's the worst acronym ever, but that's what sells the show. And he hasn't gone for it yet, but I'm way down to fight actors who think they know how to fight. And you watch their Instagram videos and their chins are sticking up as if they were looking at the sun. But I'm not trying to fight a pro fighter. That's next level athleticism. Often beats technique if you get caught and surprised. And I promise at 43 years old, I'm a lot slower than when I was 23 years old.
So when you're like, you know, you're competing and stuff, you're just having fun, you're training, but you're also like this Hollywood heartthrob. Are there agents? Are there people telling you like, stop doing this? You can't mess up the moneymaker. Did people try to get you away from martial arts later in your life?
If they did, they never said it to my face. Like me and those other guys, like, the Paul Walkers and the Scott Kahns of the world, like, we love jiu-jitsu, we love martial arts, we all train. Those were the only two guys whose black belts I respected. A lot of actors have black belts and a lot of different martial arts, and they're not black belts. But Paul's was, I never rolled with him as a black belt, only as a brown belt, but he was legit. And a relationship that I miss very much and regret. You know how, like, when you have a friend and you're like, hey, let's go get dinner. Or if you're watching the show and you're into martial arts, you're like, hey, man, let's roll, let's grapple, let's spar, whatever it is. And then you kind of put it off because you know they're there and you can do it next week. I did that a lot, man. And then, you know, a man who should have been a much closer friend just became like an acquaintance and a buddy and was gone because I didn't take advantage of that time. So there's my fatherly lesson for the day. And Scott Kahn's in Hawaii, so I can't roll jiu-jitsu with him no more. He's on Hawaii 5-0. So there's not a lot of legit dudes and girls out here. And I hate watching karate in movies because it usually sucks. And the producers are selling you on some false narrative. We had to slow down the camera speed because the actor was so fast. It's like, dude, shut up. That punch looks lame. But it is what it is, man. It's the movies. There's no fire in space, but we're all okay with that too.
So I've been dying to ask you this question. And, you know, I feel like you've been asked it before, but never on this program. So I will ask it anyway. At some point around, oh, I don't know, 10 or so years ago, I find, and you know, I was a huge pro wrestling fan. Do you know where I'm going here?
Oh yeah,
And I find out, I think reading Meltzer or something, I'm like, Freddie Prinze Jr. is on the creative team. I was like, it's not that same, like, we're not talking about like, I know what you did last summer, Freddie Prinze Jr. I still know what you did last summer, Scooby. No, like another Freddie Prinze Jr. No, the actual Freddie Prinze Jr. is on the creative team for WWE for a couple years. How the hell did this happen?
Okay, so I was at WrestleMania. I've watched wrestling my whole life. I still watch it every single week. I was at WrestleMania for Ric Flair's retirement match in Orlando, Florida. And I was approached by some of the people who worked there who knew I was familiar with the brand. If I'd ever be willing to like talk to Vince about, you know, storylines or talk to Stephanie about like storylines and stuff like that. And I was living in New York at the time. I said, sure. Stamford, Connecticut was just a train ride away. I jumped on the express, got there in 35 minutes, took a cab to Titan Towers, which I heard they're finally moving out of, which is crazy.
Yes.
And took a meeting with Stephanie. And at the end of my meeting, she said, would you consider writing for the shows? And I was like, what? She goes, yeah, I think my dad would really, you know, enjoy you. Cause you don't just say, oh, it sucks. You say, hey, I think this is a problem, but you have solutions. And I wasn't working at the time and I really wasn't wanting to work because Sarah and I were getting ready to have kids. And, it sounded crazy enough that it was cool. And I said, yes, I don't know why, but I said, yes. And I went on the road every single week to every single town for every single Raw and every single SmackDown. And they started me with just low level talent, what they considered low level, and asked me to write promos for them, like the Brian Kendrick and guys like that. And then I worked my way up to the Big Show and wrote one for him. And then I wrote a promo for The Undertaker.
Whoa.
And The Undertaker told Vince, he said, this is the best promo I've had in like 10 years. Who wrote it? And so
Wow. They
said, Freddie, you're writing for Undertaker. And when the kind of juices got flowing and I started getting better and better at it, my mentor, Michael Pure Sexy Hayes from the Fabulous Freebirds, brought in the Hardy Boys. He was responsible for bringing them to the company, and his dream was to put the belt on Jeff. But it was always a no, because of his outside the ring stuff. So I took a whole different spin on it and said, let's grab onto it with both hands. Let's show the problems that Jeff has. Let's have him discuss the fact that he can't just live this black or white life. He is the gray area. And I got a lot of this just from talking to the wrestlers. Shocker, if you talk to them, they can actually give you their voice. And then if you're a good enough writer, you can write stuff for them. But yeah, having these conversations helped a lot. And that was that, I think it was 2000, whatever, when Jeff became the champion and that whole sort of Imagination promo that he was doing. That was all me writing for him. And a lot of times holding the promo cards in different parts so he would look around all crazy and be able to find his words if he needed
them.
We had the power go out in a stadium one time and the camera was on a battery, thank God, and Stephanie ran in with like a green pen light and I grabbed a glass off a table and we just shined it on him to make him look like Heath Ledger from The Joker, rest in peace. Like we had to hustle to make these things work and he became champion and that was sort of what I got to hang my hat on for a while. And then the second time I went back was just to help the new young talent with their acting skills, how to break down their promos. We call them monologues. They call them promos. Their speeches in the ring, basically. And I just would teach them crap from acting class. Like, we would do stupid stuff like repetition, right? This is the greatest. This was me and The Miz, who's one of my favorites. He did not like me when I got there. And repetition is an exercise where you're locked into what the other person says. So I say, hey, it's a pleasure to be on your show today, Ariel. And you go, oh, it's a pleasure to be on my show today. It's a pleasure to be on your show today. Oh, it's a pleasure. And you have to go back and forth. And the goal was to make them feel stupid so that at the end of it, they're not dead and they realize, okay, if I screw up here, I'm safe. I'm willing to take more chances. It also shows them there's way more than one way to sell a line. There's like 20 ways to sell a line as long as you commit, right? So I'm explaining this. I go, are there any volunteers? Mike's hand goes up right away. I know he's going to be hot and hostile. So he gets up and I go, do you want me to start or you start? He goes, I'll start. I go, okay. And he goes, hey, I can curse on your show, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. He goes, what the fuck can you teach me about acting? And my eyes were like, because he's in, like he's locked in, right? And I go, what the fuck can I teach you about acting? And he goes, what the fuck can you teach me? I'll stop saying the F word now. Can you teach me about acting? I go, what can I teach you about? And we go back and forth. And with two guys, it always gets angry. Like it goes up and up and up. And if it's a guy and a girl, it always gets closer and sexy, right? Because they almost kiss. No matter what, it's the weirdest exercise in the world. It always happens. And so we start yelling. And finally, when he finally breaks and he can't say the line again, he just yells something else. I kind of turn and look to everybody and I go, that was amazing. And none of you are ever going to be that good at this exercise again. So we're moving on.
Wow.
And after that moment, he and I were super cool. And I loved it there, man. They literally were like, no one wanted me there in the beginning. I remember sitting there talking to him. I was like, look, man, I'm not Robert Downey Jr., but he don't give a damn about y'all. I do. So learn what you can from me and what you think sucks, throw it away. And by the time I left, they were very sad. They did not want your boy to leave. I didn't want to go, but we had a baby and I heard Stone Cold Austin say on a TV show, he won Father of the Year 0 times in that life. And I wanted to win Father of the Year every year. So I put in my 2 weeks, bounced, and that was a wrap.
Wow. That is unbelievable. What a great
yeah,
story.
Man.
I feel like you need to do like a like
Captain Greybeard story time.
You could tell a story, my man. I mean, I'm not surprised given your line of work, but I just feel like I'm hanging on every word. So it wasn't a nightmare. Cause I've heard like creative team nightmare, like you're beaten down and it's like long hours and you're traveling. You actually enjoyed it?
The hours are tough, man. The hours are a tap out for sure. It's like a choke where the guy's not squeezing you hard. It's just, he slowly gets tighter and tighter and tighter. And they give everyone 6 months. Like JBL used to, for the first 6 months I was there, called me 6 months because that's how long he gave me.
Wow.
And then after that, he called me Freddie and I got to write a promo for him and Vince rewrote it. And he was like, he has to say it this way and tell him to say it my way. Damn it. And, I was like, all right. And so I go to JBL and I'm like, hey man, Vince wants you to say it word for word like this. And so we got to work on it. And he goes, no, we don't need to work on it. I got it. I got it. No, we really need to work on it. He goes, oh, I got it. I got it. So I have to go now. It's my segment and JBL's music comes and he goes out there and he's supposed to talk about how the government's giving him this bailout because he's rich, right? So that the crowd will hate him. And he doesn't. He does what I wrote instead. And Vince is like hitting me. He's like, God damn it, Freddie. I told you, you son of a bitch. And just screaming. I'm sitting there. I'm like, I'm sorry, man. And I don't want to throw JBL into the bus. So I go, look, I thought my promo was better. I thought the other one was too like Reaganomics 80s style. And this is more contemporary because I did it on purpose like that. And he's just drilling me. I'm like, all right, man. Okay. I'm sorry. I won't do it again. So I get thrown out of Gorilla. JBL comes backstage. Totally like takes the bullet for me and tells the truth. And I think it was like a test to see what kind of a dude I was, to see like if I would throw someone under the bus to save my own ass or not. So I passed that test and I got a lot of love from Vince after that. So now I was invited on the jet after I flew on the jet.
Oh man. Did you ever get like hazed? Like, is there like a big hazing process early on? I know you said they called you 6 months and they didn't want you there, but did anyone do anything like really mean to you?
John Cena and I were the only ones who really didn't get along. Like he,
wow.
It got to the point where, and I respect what John brought to WWE. He had to hold that company on his shoulders during the PG era when no one else wanted to. That could have been Hunter, but he didn't want that cross. He wanted to be more rated R and do the stuff he liked to do. John took that upon himself. So for that, wrestling fans should be grateful because it's what made the company enough money to go in the direction that hopefully we all wanted to go in. But we did not get along and he did not like that I was there. I think he called me Ashton Kutcher for like the first 3 months I was there and walked into one of the acting classes in the middle of it and just sat down in the middle of the class and in between the two wrestlers. And I go, yo, man, let me talk to you outside for a minute.
Oh.
He comes outside, and I'm not one to have, like, confrontation with some, you know, giant muscle head dude, but I'm not going to take shit off anybody, or otherwise you're dead at that company. So we go outside. I'm like, look, bro, you're not in this class because you know how to do this, but you don't want to teach these guys or girls shit. So let me do my job. Let me do what Vince wants me. I'd say Vince's name so he knows. I said, let me do what Vince wants me to do and just stay out of here. And to his credit, he goes, look, I know I approach this stuff in a barbaric sort of way, but you either got it or you don't. I said, dude, you're right about that, but you can get better or worse depending on the type of instruction you have. And do you want them to have instruction from Vince in the promo class or from me? And to give you an example of Vince's promo classes, he had Wade Barrett and Sheamus stand up in front of every wrestler, every producer, that's ex-wrestler, like agent, choreographer, whatever you want to call him, everyone in the company in this boardroom. And he looks at them both and he goes, you're a dog and you're a dog. Now make me want to watch you fight. And the room is dead quiet. No one could say anything. It's so quiet that after a full minute, Sheamus says accidentally, I think I'm having an out-of-body experience. Doesn't know he said it. The whole room goes crazy. Vince yells, you're a dog. Both of them get quiet again. Wade Barrett, God bless him, is the courageous one in this instance, and he starts first. But after the second you're a dog, he thought he was supposed to be a dog, so he barked.
Oh.
Vince jumps up, flips a table over that has all the Monday Night Raw scripts on it, with like six people scripts, protein drinks that he drinks all day long, his protein bars that are laid out, everything flies off the table. He goes, ah, damn it, storms out. I go up to Vince after. I say, hey, man, maybe I could take over the promo class because I think I could speak that language that you're speaking and then translate it to them, because you're using terms like razzle dazzle and they just don't know what that means. And he handed me the promo class. And that's where we started the repetition stuff and a bunch of other crap that I won't bore you with. But wow. I have so much love for those guys and girls. I always will. I still have relationships with a lot of them. They mean a lot to me. And they're the most blue collar people that I've ever had the privilege of being in business with. You know, actors just aren't that blue collar. Producers certainly are not blue collar, but wrestlers are the most blue collar. Even John, the most blue collar people I ever worked with.
True or false, you cannot sneeze in front of Vince McMahon. He views it as a sign of weakness. Is that true?
Not weakness, but he hates germs and he finds it disgusting. So it's not a sign of weakness. He's not this alpha personality that everybody thinks. He's an omega personality. Like, the best way to figure this out, alpha, beta, omega. That's not a dumb actor telling you stuff. That's Sigmund Freud.
Sure.
And everybody possesses all three, but there's a dominant trait. And the easiest way to tell which one someone is to compliment or criticize them. If you compliment Kobe Bryant, he is an alpha personality. Kobe, you're the best. Yeah, I know. Kobe, you suck. Yeah, whatever. He doesn't care. He's already made a decision how he feels about himself. The beta personality, now that's more actors, musicians, artists, that's very susceptible to compliments and criticism. So you say, Sally Field, you like me, you really like me, when she won an Academy Award. Like, she didn't know she was already great before that? That's insane. But most actors are like that. A lot of basketball players you'll see is a lot of passive aggressiveness is associated with the beta. And the omega personality, which is what Vince is the long-term thinker. Vince, WWE's the best, or Kobe's the alpha. Vince, WWE's the best. What does he want from me? That's all they think about. You're not affecting how they feel about the product. They simply want to know what you want. They're only thinking end game. And that's what Vince is. He works backwards. We write the show from WrestleMania backwards. Here are the four matches that I want. Get me there. And we would be like, all right, and give it our best shot.
Fascinating stuff. Now, I feel like you're the perfect person to ask this question, considering your background in that world and considering your background in the world of acting as well. One thing that bothers me about the UFC today is that everyone looks the same. Everyone dresses the same. They wear uniforms. There's too many events. They go week to week. We can't tell stories. We can't tell who these people are. When you watch it, do you feel like you need to be emotionally invested in these guys, right, in their journey, in these females? Do you feel like that's a problem in MMA these days?
I mean, there's definitely something to that, because my favorite fighters are really the ones I know personally. You don't get a big opportunity to learn about the fighters unless they're on shows like this. Why do you have me on? You should be getting to know a UFC fighter right now. But once they sign that Reebok deal, you know, a lot of these people just can't get their personality over. Like Angie Hill, right? Overkill right. Hill.
Yeah.
She's a cosplayer. She's a friend of mine. We got big love for her. And her cosplay at the weigh-ins is heavily limited. Like all she can really do now is face paint because of all these rules of what you can and can't wear. So it's very hard for the fighters to get anything over but fighting. Now you may have a lot of fans that go, well, that's the way it should be. But I don't know if that's how you grow the sport. And ESPN should know better. But we need to be patient because ESPN is very new to the MMA game. I know a lot of people have problems with it. I do too. But they've signed you. They have other people who aren't just intelligent on fighting but aren't grossed out by it. They still have a few anchors who are grossed out by it, which I don't know why they would help them sell the sport, but they make them do that. But give them time. It's a massive company, which at least buys you time to get it right. And I think they will eventually, but they're definitely, you have to sort of be a star in the ring for the UFC to sell you right now. You don't have the opportunity to build up anything outside the ring except Ben Askren. And then he got obliterated. But I think the way he handled it, you can't really humiliate him too much with it anymore. He's just going to go and fight and have his UFC career.
Can you send my best to Buffy? My wife is a big Buffy fan. Can you tell her we say hello?
I will.
Yes.
I definitely will send her some love. I just dropped my kid off at camp and someone had a dog with a service vest on it and it had a steak on one side and on the other side it said Buffy's Beast. So I know she still gets mad love all over the world.
Yes.
When we went on our honeymoon in Bali almost 20 years ago, a random taxi driver that we had who didn't even speak English was like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, he was all in. I've never seen an episode, but I hear it's great.
And really? Never? Is that true? I don't believe you.
I swear. I saw part of the musical number because I had a buddy doing a part in it, this tap dancer, Hitting Battles, who was really good friends with Dule Hill from She's All That, who's on Suits. And he's a good friend of mine, world-class tap dancer. He's like, yo, you got to check out Hitting Battles. So I watched him. He played the devil in an episode, but I wasn't the demographic, man.
Fair enough.
You know what I mean? I was watching live sports and playing video games.
Okay, last one. It's the most important one. Fact or fiction. I still know what you did last summer is better than I know what you did last summer.
Fiction? Is that a thing? That's fiction, bro.
I feel that way.
The first one is way better.
Okay.
The original cast kills. Muse Watson is the solo killer. I think it was Matthew Settle played the other son in the second one. That doesn't hold up as well as the first one. First, okay. I know you did last summer all day. Don't believe the hype. James Wan is not doing that pilot, internet.
Oh.
Deal with it.
Okay. I saw that as well. No remake. Okay. Wow. Look at you. Breaking news. I love it.
I just like hurting people's feelings.
Freddie, this has been an absolute pleasure. I'm happy we finally got to do it. I'm happy you took some time out of your schedule. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. Anytime you want me on your show, whenever you do the ESPN LA thing, it's an absolute honor and a privilege to be on with you guys. So thank you so much.
No, thank you, man. It's my pleasure. I have way less gray hair on the radio, so anytime you want to do it, I'm down.
Okay.
And don't forget, Uwafel.
Yes.
It's going to be the new fight sensation.
All right.
Uwafel.
All right. We're on that. Thank you, Freddie. All the best to you. There he is, the one and only Freddie Prinze Jr. Uwafel. So last week we had Steve-O pushing it, and now we've got Freddie Prinze. Who will be on next week? Stay tuned. And for all you people who are like, why is he on? Why is he on? You see why? You see the knowledge? You see the street cred? Just trust me, okay? Enough. Trust me. All right. Let's talk UFC 240 again. Big story. Chris Cyborg, big win over Felicia Spencer. What a win. What a comeback. What a story. One fight left on her deal. She goes in there. She takes all her shots. She keeps on going. One of her most impressive victories. Don't listen to anyone else. And now we wonder what's next for her. Let's ask her. Here she is. Chris Cyborg, the one and only. Chris, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Ariel. I'm great. My voice a little bit worse.
Oh.
Canada was too cold, too hot, too cold. I know voice now.
Well, it's great to have you here. You and I both, we're both battling a sore throat. I appreciate you doing this. What a great moment for you to come back after the loss to Amanda Nunes, to be resilient, to suffer your first cut. Are you happy with that fight? It went the distance, but you know, you won 30-27. She was tough as heck. Are you happy though with everything you did in that fight?
You know, I was really happy. I think everybody can see when I walked to the octagon, I was really happy. I enjoyed the time, every moment, and going to the octagon, I'm really happy about the fight. Felicia, she's tough. You know, I'm happy she can handle a little bit because I have more time staying octagon, you know. Our fight is like all the rounds, the 30-27. She cut me in first minute. But, you know, I continue going. And then I know I put a lot of work and on the fight. I think I improved a lot. I learned a lot. And I'm really happy with the results.
Was she tougher than you expected? I know that you have a lot of respect for Felicia and you've been talking about it for a bit. But, like, did you expect her to be that tough and take those kinds of shots?
You know, all the time, sometimes when I touch really hard to her, I saw her want quit, but don't quit. You know, sometimes I see her eyes and I start to see her face. If we have more two rounds, for sure, you know, the finish is going to, I think the 1 minute after the third round, I think I was going to finish. You know, I was starting to break her slow.
Considering all the talk going into that fight, now that it's over, about your contract and you know, trying to get the leverage and all that, did you feel pressure going into this one? The Nunes fight was, you know, back in December. Like, did you feel a little more nervous than usual?
No, I have no feel any pressure. I was feel free when I go to fight. I feel free. I feel happy and thankful for having the opportunity to fight again. You know, after my last fight, I asked to fight soon possible, and I just have the opportunity to fight Felicia in Canada. But I'm really happy. You know, I walk happy. I went to the octagon, no pressure, no any pressure. You know, just I stayed 13 years undefeated, a champion, and it's really hard. And when I don't have this thing in my back anymore, I just go there and enjoy my time.
Right after the fight, you went down on the mat. You put your head on the ground and you went and almost embraced the fans. Joe Rogan had to wait for a second. What were you feeling in that moment?
You know, the fans showed a lot of love all the week I was there. You know, I was running the street every day and the fans stopped me. You know, the Canadian people is really nice. Then very friendly, loyal. And I have a lot of fans there and just show love for them. You know, then really happy with me there. You can see when I go out into the crowd really happy. The Cyber Nation, Canada, you know, everybody very happy. It is just a show love for them back.
Chris, was that your last UFC fight?
In the contract, yes.
No, but do you think that will be your last one? What do you feel right now?
You know, I think a lot of things have to fix and change for you can have more fights at UFC. You know, everybody follow my career and knows how's my struggle with UFC. You know, I never start fighting UFC because the promotion want me be there. No, it's defense pressure because I have the opportunity to be in UFC because UFC, my fans put so much pressure want me be there because this I was there. It's not because then wanted me there. And because my fan base and because people love my fights, then really do. And I feel very blessed because this. And because this I have the opportunity, but they don't help me and they don't help growing my brand all the time. Then try damage my brand, especially Dana White, you know, and he's the head at UFC. You look UFC, who's the face of UFC? Dana White. And if he continue damage my brand, he's damaged a long time ago, you know, like start when I was in Strikeforce. He's don't have Umas MMA. He's aware to start doing this. You know, I don't know what's his problem. But he's continue doing this. I was just prove he's wrong. You know, all the time the fans start to know who I am, then see who's the liar, who's the person very frustrated because I cannot see when people happy want to damage another brand, another person, if you're happy, you know, because people, I don't know, people like watch my fights. You can see all the results. And you can see the fight too. This Saturday, I throw more punches than anybody for the event. You can see the strike, the percentage. And they make it look like the fight was close. You know, it's even close. It's 30-27. Joe Rogan commentated the fight, looked like the fight is very hard fight. No, you know, it's hard to work with people like this. It's really hard.
afterwards, I understand you saw Dana backstage. What did you say to him and what did he say to you?
I look at his eyes and I shake his hand and I say, why you lie? I text you in your phone after the fight. I want my rematch. And then I say, why are you doing this? Why? And he doesn't have word, and because I have a lot of cameras there too, you know, and I to look at his face, and I didn't know he's doing interview before me. I was waiting him finish for me can do my interview. And then when I asked him, I said, man, why are you lying? I talked to him. I said, man, I want the rematch. We just have to sit down and figure out how I was going to do that. Then I never offering the fight for me. Then just offering on contract is 6 fights in contract. But the problem, the UFC put me fight one time per year. I'm not going to, who's going to fight after Amanda? If you know, if you don't want to make the deal, one fight deal, no extension. I don't want the extension. Does the rematch. And I'm free. I don't have any problem to make the fight. Now we want to give you on contract 6 fights. In one time per year, imagine how long you're going to be in UFC. And then my brain not going to grow in because I'm going to fight one time per year. And then I'll help my name growing, just damage. And this is no help for me. You know, it's no very good. And after I talked to him, I didn't know he's talking bad things about me before. Ah, oh, she's afraid. Man, I'm not afraid. I'm a fighter. You know, I mean, I'm born for this. I don't know. I know what Dana White before he tried to be a fighter. I know this. You know, I hear about he tried to be a fighter and he's not have a lot of success. And I think when you see one girl have a success and then do the best and they go to the fight and the fans love her, I think this is making problem for him. I think his ego. I think it hurts his ego. You know, I think because I don't have any, I don't know what's his problem because people love watching my fights, then enjoy. You know, they follow me everywhere I'm going. You know, they follow me in Lichaxi, go to Strike Force, go to Invicta, you know, go to web, I go to FC, all my fans base go with me. And I really don't understand. But you know, I'm willing for B make the deal, you know, but I think Dana White is supposed, say I'm sorry for everything he's doing for me, you know. I suffer bully, abuse. You know, you go in my Instagram, everybody, people call me, I'm a man, I have a dick, because the joke he's doing, you know. Okay, take a little, he did the joke about I look like Wanderlei Silva in the dress. A lot of people go to my Instagram, do this. I suffer bully. Where is the code for you cannot have this? He's the boss. How is the boss make fun? They are athlete. It's a girl. Say, she's have a penis. She's a guy. You know, they have to have rules. You know, have to, this is no right. I have a daughter. I have mom. I have a dad. My daughter had a problem in school already because this. You know, I don't think cool. I think he's a bully guy. And I think he's have to pay what he's doing. He's damaged my brand. His my self-esteem. You know, because I'm strong, because I don't let the things no make a problem for me, but make with my family this. And I think this is have to change, but he's don't change his lie. He's continue doing this, continue bullying me. And who's going to stop him? Who is the boss to him? He's have a boss. He's supposed to have a boss. Who's going to stop him? He says, right, you work for someone, your boss, and he's bullying you, and you have to continue working. And then people say, I'm hard to work, but man, I'm not. I love my job. I have a lot of bosses before. Scott, Shanna, and the Invicta, then before work with me. They know I'm not hard to work. Now, how's it going to work one guy call you a man and say you have a penis? And then continue doing this. You know, I don't know. It's no right.
Has he ever apologized to you privately about these comments?
No, he never apologized. Never apologized. And then Joe Rogan, the first time when I fought UFC, he's had to interview me. And before he interviewed me, he came say, I'm sorry. Because I was not going to say any one word for him. Because there's the other guy too. He's trying to manipulate all my fan base. The people listen to him. and he's trying to manipulate everything because his team, Dana White, the homies, together, you know, and they both together want to damage my brand. I don't know what's their problems, really.
And so now you have this situation where he's saying, okay, I'm going to, we'll do one fight, or we offered you a fight, things like that. But is it not true, Chris, that attached to that, like when they offered you the rematch, they wanted you to sign a 6-fight extension. You felt that that money wasn't, you know, what you were worth, even though you were coming off a loss. So it's not just, oh, we offered you a rematch. No, there's strings attached to this. And that's not being said, correct?
Yeah, so we have to fix the money too. It's no, we have to fix this. And I told him, Dana White's face, say, man, we're not going to get a rematch. If you want to pay that money, you got the frames for 6 fights. Because I'm going to stay stuck with 6 fights. We're going to fight one time per year. Dana White, you're going to continue damage my brand. Not going to grow in my brand. And what's the willing for me? This, you know, it's no good. It's no good. Why am I going to choose this? And I told him, okay, let's sit down with my manager and see what's the good, going to be good for me. Can be good for you, good for me. You know, both of you can make money and do the fight. Everybody want to watch the fight. And I asked the rematch after my last fight. They don't give me. They say, no, she need to fight Holly Holm. And after this, man, fight you. Then you can see for fight Amanda Nunes, I was the champion. They make me wait 9 months. And then another thing, okay, I wait 9 months, then change the event the week the fight. I have to change the flight, the whole my family, my corner, and pay you my money. And the UFC say you're going to pay me back. They never pay me back. Okay, now this fight I did in Canada. I was did in my camp in South Africa. Then I paid my own ticket for go to my fight. I pay my corner ticket for go to the fight. Do you think I want to renew my contract with a promotion like this? Like I'm paying for fight. Like I don't let this bore me, you know, annoy me. Because okay, I pay. I say my manager, man, I pay. I don't care. I pay. No problem. We pay. I just go there and do my last fight. Like I don't. And then everything they did the whole week the fight. Don't know why to go on media, try, say I'm a liar. This is no damage my brand. This is no help me. You know, I don't know. UFC want to sign the deal with me. They want that me continue to be there. And then why they doing this? You know, why they don't pay the money? They don't pay the money they own me. Why I don't pay my own ticket for me go fight? Don't pay my corner ticket. You know, why?
Considering all these feelings and this past and all these issues that you have, why would you even consider? Now you're free, right? No more fights. Why would you even consider for 1 second re-signing with the UFC?
You know, I think because the fans would like to watch the rematch. You know, my fans, Cyber Nation, I'm a lawyer for them. But they didn't have to understand. They don't help us. They don't help us. If you, I mean, I did my first fight UFC because Cyber Nation asked for me, put me there. But then they want to damage our brand. They don't help us. And I know the value of my name and the value of my job. I know I'm not old. You know, if I'm old, I'm the savage old because Saturday, man, I did a very good strike on my opponents. The most fighter throw more strike in the event. And yesterday in the Google, I'm the number 6. Everybody go Chris Cyborg. Man, we're still in life. And I know I have it. If I be a free agent and looking for another opportunity, I know they're not going to know my value. You just know the value of someone when you lost. It's like a relationship, like marriage. When you lost, you know, man, why I mean, you know why I lost, but you just know when you lost. And I given the UFC, given the opportunity for the better. But Dana White not doing better. He's going online, lie everywhere.
So it's clear that you want the fight as well because you were wearing a t-shirt afterwards that said Cyborg Nunes 2 coming January 2020. But then you said, and you did media wearing this. You were on the ESPN Plus post-fight show wearing this shirt. And there's the photo right over there. But then when you went to the press conference, you weren't wearing the shirt. What happened?
UFC making me take out the shirt.
Why?
They say you don't allow to use that shirt. Because Dana White lying say I'm no one to do the rematch. Why am I going to do the rematch if I make the shirt? You know, I want rematch. My fans know this. You know, they don't want that. And then he tried manipulate it. She don't want to rematch. And then I wear the shirt they forced me to take out. They control you. You know, you know, employ it, but then tell you everything you have to do. You have to wear a uniform. You have to use what they want to use, but you know, employ it. You know, and it's funny how it works this. And then funny because the fans don't know. Fans just don't know what Dana White said. You know, and just what they see in the media. They don't know the reality inside how dirty MMA world it is. You know, I even don't know about how dirty. When I started doing MMA, I'm so naive. I didn't know how it work. And when I start figure out how it work, and the people ask me, you want your daughter do box? I say, no, I don't want my MMA. No, I don't want my daughter do anything. I want she study. She do her, be on her own boss, you know, because it's very dirty. They manipulate everything. Media, they have money. Then if you want to damage your brand, they're going to do. And the 140 example, my fight's 140. But if she don't did this for help me, you know, then try almost kill me. For me, lose my fight for it. Can, they don't need to open the division for me, you know. And then I told them I'm not going to fight 140 anymore after my first fight. They say, no, you're going to fight or you leave. You're going to fight or leave. I just bought my house. You know, I said, man, you know, I have to do this fight. And after the fight, I almost had a hard time. I say, you know, I'm not going to do this no more. If I die here, only my mom, my family going to cry. You know, I'm going to fight on 45 any place. And then they open my division. But then, oh, the beginning already, they don't want to help me. You know, they don't want.
Could you tell us what the timeline is now? Like, are you free to talk to other people today? Is there an exclusive negotiation period? What could you tell us about your contract?
You know, I have 3 months. I have to talk to FC for try negotiation. Let's see what's then coming back. We open for a deal with this. Then contact us, talk to us. I for sure, if it's one thing good for me, you know, I'm willing. I want to fight. I want my rematch. And then I'm willing to do this. And after 3 months, I have the option for see all the opportunities at other events and see what they're going to offer for me. And I can do my best to choose for me.
Is it?
And
is,
for my brand.
Is it 100%? Like, will you play out those 3 months? Do you want to test the waters? Or if they come to you within those 3 months and give you a deal that you're happy with and give you the rematch, everything that you want, maybe even Dana apologizes to you and the relationship is fixed, would you be willing to sign before that period is over?
No, I want to listen the option they have. And I want to listen the option I have outside, you know, and I'm going to see what's the best deal for me. Because you know what, just about me, I want to fight more than one time per year. I don't want to want promotion damage my brand, because after I stop fighting, I'm going to leave it with my name. And if one company have a lot of money and a lot of control of the media and they want to damage your brand, then try a lot of years, you know, but man, God with me and this fight with me and the people start to see who's cyborg, who's a real cyborg and then still with me. And, but I want to see the option and see what's going to be good for me and good for my brand, because my brand is who I am. And my brand, when I stop fighting, it's what I'm going to leave with.
Does Dana White have to apologize to you in order for you to resign?
Of course. He's have to apologize. I think he's have family. He's have kids. I think he's one guy honest. He's supposed to do this. I think he's, I don't know if he's have a heart, but I think what he's doing is not just touch me if he don't like me. He's touching people around me. He's touching my family. And it's not right. It's not right. Of course, he wants to avoid his family, everything he does. And then like me. But when he's doing this type of things, he's not avoiding my family. You know, he's touching them.
Publicly or privately? Is it okay if it's privately, or do you want him to say something publicly about you? As far as apology.
No, public.
Public. Okay.
It's
yeah.
Easy. It's easy to talk to you. Go like John Rogan. John Rogan like him. He's go say, I'm sorry for me when they don't have cameras just by myself. You know, no, you have to, You have to tell you what to talk about me. If I have a dick, you talk in public. You know, you talk in public. You say, I'm sorry. Talk to public. You are not man. You're not man. For me, you're not man. Because if Joe Rogan is a man, he's going to say, I'm sorry in public, like it, what he said. Don't come in behind and in the room talk to me very in my ear. I'm sorry. This is not type of man I know.
I have a theory, Chris, that all this stems from your quote-unquote feud with Ronda Rousey back in the day, that they were so enamored with Ronda that they viewed you as, you know, the foil to her, you know, to her stardom, and they just can't seem to get over that. That's my theory. No one has told me that, but that's what I feel, because I can't understand how you can watch that fight on Saturday and say, oh, that Chris Cyborg doesn't want to fight Amanda Nunes. That Chris Cyborg wants nothing to do with Amanda Nunes. She's smart for not taking that. I can't wrap my head around that line of thinking. Am I crazy here, or have you thought the same thing?
Man, I don't know. It's the same. I don't know. I think in the beginning, okay, Amanda, Ronda, she's talk about me, damage my brand because she don't want to fight me. And she want, because she have all the marks behind her, and she can manipulate all the fans. And she did it for a while, you know? And people say she's the greatest. She's the best in the world. You never hear me. I'm saying I'm the greatest. I'm the best in the world. I was never going to lose. I never say that. You know, all my fans think this about me is different. When you talk about yourself, is different than when people tell you. You know, I don't need to be the best. Everybody say, Amanda is the greatest. Man, I don't care. I don't care if she tell her she's the greatest or some fans say that. But she don't did it for the sport why I did. You know, I've been doing this 14 years. I stayed 13 years undefeated. I'm a 3 champion in 3 different organizations. You know, what I did for the sport, I growing for Uma's MMA. You know, if she's fighting now, it's because I will start this. You know, I don't care. It's the greatest. You know, what she did for the sport. Now she's doing, okay, she's the champion. Other thing, I lost for the champion. She had 4 lost her career, and she's not lost for the champion. You know, a lot of things that people didn't do. She didn't say this, but you know, I looking for what I did for the sport. You know, and then she says the greatest or not, this is no means anything for me. You know, I just, it means like what I did for sports. And I'm really happy to see girls fighting. And I'm really happy to have events, have girls looking for me. And tell me, Chris, you're the legend. I respect you. You know, because then when I start training, when I start fighting, don't have guys, don't have girls. Ronda come after too. Ronda come after. You know, and then start say Ronda start in Muslim MMA. You lie. You use your media. You use your money for your life for people, and some people don't look at the stuff. You know, and then they control everything. Like the first belt was 45 pound. Supposed to be me fight. I was sick. What they did? They take out my name, the history. The first title belt 145 pounds. There was no me fighting for the title because they control. And control everything, you know. But I know the fans know what I'm doing for the sport. And because this, even I'm no champion, even after my loss, my fans with me, my brand growing more than you know. This means a lot for me because I'm your world champion inside the hearts, the people. You know, you can hold the belt, any belt you hold, but if you're not champion, the people's hearts. Man, we don't have nothing, you know, because after you lost the belt, after no champion, this is people forgot about. But people know, remember me because I'm the world champion inside their hearts. And this is nobody can take out of me.
All right. Chris, I know a lot of people are watching this. Is there anything else that you want to say before we say goodbye? Anything that you feel like I didn't touch on?
You know, I'm going to say thank you for my fans, Cyber Nation. I know, follow me on my YouTube channel and... And you know, I want a rematch. I'm willing for do this deal. I want Dana White, Hunter, whatever. Talk to my manager. Let's sit down. Let's be honest. Maybe first time in your life, Dana White. Let's be honest. You know, let's not send people talk to me. Come you straight and sit down and talk what you want to do. And you know, I'm willing for the one fight deal. No clauses, no more fight extension. Doesn't matter if I get out that champion. I want one fight deal. And then be honest. You know, stop lying. Look to my eyes. You know, no hide behind the camera, no hide behind anything. Joe Rogan too. You know, if you don't like me, come to my face and talk to me. Don't come behind the cameras and say, I'm sorry, my ear. If you, you know, this is not man's things. It is not man. There's no man to be proud of this. You know, it's easy. These guys are not considered like a good man. Then say behind in cameras, but in front of you, they don't tell you anything.
Thank you very much.
So I just want to say thank you, my fans, and let's wait. I'm very excited. This is new chapter in my life, my career. You know, I'm very motivated. I'm training really hard. Everybody see my last fight. You know, I have a little bit of patience. You know, it's a Felicia. Thank you for fight with me. You know, she's the girl. She's going to be a lot of work for all the girls. She's tough. She's young. She's just don't have experience, but you know, she's gonna be on top. And I just thank you for her. I don't shake her hands. No, because of her, I don't shake her hand because if I shake her hand, I need to shake Dana White's hand. And I was not willing to do that. Okay. You know, I was focused for my fight and I shake her hand in the hotel. I talk to her in the hotel and it's nothing about her. It's no disrespect to my opponents.
Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate this very much, and I wish you the best with this negotiation, and congratulations on the victory. Thank you for coming on and explaining how you're feeling today.
Thanks so much, Ariel. Always you give the opportunity for me, and that's it. Let's see what's next.
Okay.
Thank you.
Best of luck to you. Obrigado. There she is, Chris Cyborg. A lot to get out there, and we very much appreciate her time on the show today, coming on the program and talking about it. Let's move on now to our next guest, one of the very best boxing promoters in the game. It was a tough week for boxing last week. Wanted to get his thoughts on that and how the sport moves on. It's a story that affects us here in the world of MMA as well. Lou DiBella, kind enough to join us right now. Lou, how are you?
I'm good, Ariel. Good to be with you.
Yeah, and I'm sorry for the delay there. There was a lot to get to with Chris, as you can see. I'm sure you've been in situations like that before with a fighter who's very passionate about their cause, so appreciate your patience. Last week was horrific for the sport of boxing that you love so much, and I love what you did on social media. I feel like you're one of the few who came out there and said, we have a problem. We need to fix things. We can't just gloss over these tragedies. Two deaths in the span of a few days. Could you describe right now, as someone who makes their living in the sport of boxing, predominantly, I know you work in baseball as well, but that's your bread and butter. How do you feel about combat sports, you know, a few days later after seeing tragedies like that?
You know, it's a complicated issue because I think a lot of people are saved by combat sports. I mean, it's not, for the most part, rich kids that are engaging in combat sports. It's kids that have to overcome something. People that have to come out of bad circumstances fighting to get to a better place. So there's inherent risk, but there's inherent risk in football. Look at the issues with CTE and concussion in football. There's inherent risks in hockey. There's inherent risks in car racing, and you can go through the list. People have a right to absorb a certain amount of risk, but we got to do better to protect our athletes. That's the bottom line in all of combat sports. And in some ways it's easier, I think, maybe for UFC to institute protections because their authority is centralized. Like boxing is the wild, wild west. Who's going to enforce anything? Who's going to implement it? There is no commission. There's no commissioner. There's no one dominant organization. We got to do better. And the thing is, the stuff I said on social media the past week, I can go back 25 years to when I started saying the same things. We still don't have uniform health and safety standards. You know, the late Senator John McCain had me testify before Congress and I testified in favor of a federal commission because I believed, you know, we need to have uniform rules and regulations that govern safety and health. And there aren't any. And in most of the states in the United States, this wouldn't have saved, by the way, Max Dadashoff. But think about the fact that in the majority of the states, all you need to compete is an AIDS test and an eye test. And there's not an adequate database for health and safety. Guys can have issues and be suspended, and those suspenders aren't known to other jurisdictions, and people fight. I mean, the death in Argentina was totally avoidable. The guy was on suspension. And of all fucking things, his father put him in the fight before the suspension was over.
You still there? Okay, yeah. Maybe you were getting call or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to continue with that thought?
Yeah. Not only that, there's a huge gap in regulation now in the state level. If you go into New York and you have a serious problem, and you go in to get licensed, and you have your
you're a busy man, Lou.
I apologize.
No problem.
If you go in and you go into New York and you go to get your license and they find a major problem, they don't suspend you because you never were licensed. So because you weren't suspended, you're not on a suspension list. You're not in any database. So therefore you just go to another jurisdiction where they don't do a head test, where they don't do any other type of particular test other than an eye. Like if all you have to do is get an eye test and an AIDS test, you could find most places and be totally messed up. But you can go into one of the best medical states in the union in terms of combat sports, New York, and go in for a license. They can find a major problem. And by virtue of the fact you weren't licensed in the first place, that major problem isn't communicated elsewhere. So you're allowed to go elsewhere where you can permanently damage your health. Hmm. And that's got to change. We need uniform health and safety standards across 50 states. We need to get much stricter on PEDs. PED testing in boxing is an absolute joke. You know, that wasn't an issue in either one of those, to my knowledge, in either one of those deaths last week. But we're not doing the basic things we can be doing. That needs to change. We also need to change our mindset. And I even need to change my mindset. Because I'll tell you in a second something I said the other night, and then I realized I'm contradicting myself with all my health and safety talk. The Dadashaw fight, there was nothing wrong with the matchup. He was an accomplished fighter. That you really can't blame the referee. You really can't. Well, the ringside doctor, I was wondering where he was. And by the way, ringside physicians in combat sports should have neurological training. They should be trained with respect to concussion. And they're not. And by virtue of the fact they're not, we have no concussion protocols. There's no concussion protocols to implement. That's wild. Think about the fact that there are no concussion protocols in a combat sports that can go 10 or 12 rounds of 3-minute rounds. And we tend to complain when a doctor jumps into the ring in the middle of a round to check out the contestant. Well, if the guy's like concussed, I don't care when it is in the round. Get in there and look into it. And if the fight needs to be stopped, stop it. I think maybe we need some kind of mercy rule, Ariel. In the Dadashaw fight, there is no rule to this effect. But if you're losing every round and you're getting pounded and you're taking headshots and you're down 6 rounds to nothing or 7 rounds to nothing, why let the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th round, 12th round go on? Why? The guy's not going to win. You know, it's sustained beatings that cause death or permanent injury. It's not one punch. It's not the hammer of Thor or Deontay Wilder's right hand that kills somebody. It's a sustained beating over a long period of time. And by the way, I'm a purist. Most boxing fans are. But if we do research and we find that shorter rounds are going to save lives and prevent CTE and death in the ring, if we find that fewer rounds are going to do that, if we find that smaller gloves, which I've talked to many neurologists, and they suggest that smaller gloves are actually safer. If that stuff's the case, the hell with purism, you know? Do what you need to do. Last week was really depressing to me, and I don't want to go through a week like that again.
There is a negative stigma, and I really appreciate you laying it out like that. There's a negative stigma in our sport, MMA, when someone, you know, throws in the towel, so to speak, a corner stops. The fighters always say there was an ugly scene around a year and a half or so ago where a fighter, Raquel Pennington, was asking her corner to stop the fight, and they said no. They said, you got to go out there. Unfathomable to me.
That goes to the change in mindset I was suggesting.
But does that stigma exist in boxing as well?
Huge. I've been guilty of it. Everyone has been. That guy quit like a dog. You hear that all the time. Or that woman quit like a dog. No. We're not in their skin. They know if they have double vision. They know if they have a headache or they feel dizzy or some kind of damage is being done to them. They know. You know better about how you feel. A fighter doesn't owe it to us to die. This isn't about living to fight another day. It's about living another day. Living another day with your faculties. So I'm really making an effort. You're not going to hear me say anymore that guy quit or that woman quit. you know, if they're quitting out of frustration, maybe, but if they're quitting in any sense in a fight where they're losing or being beaten up, they got to protect themselves. They got to go back to their families. I said that, like, the other day I was in my fighter, Tevin Farmer, who's a brilliant boxer. Mm-hmm. He dominated a guy from pillar to post who was a number one world rank contender, and he dominated him. He won, in my mind, all but one round, and it was completely conclusive. And there was a lot of brilliant defense in his part, but it wasn't the most scintillating fight in the world. And after the fight, the crowd in Texas was booing because it wasn't a bloodbath. And a couple of writers came up to me and they were going, "Oh, that wasn't an exciting fight. That was a pretty terrible fight." And I said, "Look, it was a completely dominant performance. You know, but I'm going to mention to Tevin, maybe he has to think about being more entertaining." And Tevin reacted very negatively to that. And he was completely right. He was right. I was wrong. Here's the bottom line. You know, maybe guys go into cruise control in a long fight when you're dominating another guy and what you're doing is working. But he doesn't have to take punches to make me happy. He doesn't have to take punches to get the crowd screaming. Two of my favorite fighters and best friends I've had in boxing, Arturo Gatti and Mickey Ward, fought three of the most savage fights in history. Arturo's dead. Mickey got diagnosed, even though they haven't sliced his brain, but he got diagnosed by a major university neurological unit as having CTE. And he's suffering right now, you know, with symptoms of CTE, really bad ones. You know, okay, those were the two greatest blood and guts warriors in boxing in recent years. One of them's dead, one of them has CTE. Tevin Farmer doesn't owe that to me, to you, to the crowd, or anyone else. So if you're out there and it's the sweet science and you can dominate someone without being hit, that's your job. Your job is to win, get hit, and hurt as little as possible in achieving a victory. And the other night, I like hearing the crowd booing, listening to the writer asking me the question about the fight being less than scintillating. I reacted viscerally instead of thinking about the week I just had. And Tevin, with his response to what I said, nailed it on the head. You know, his job is to win, to keep supporting his family, to go home healthy, and ultimately to retire from a combat sport without permanent damage.
Yeah, it was Mike Coppinger, who's I think a great boxing reporter, tweeted that quote from you, and then Tevin retweeted it with a quote saying, "More entertaining, like take more risk and more punches to the head just to be another fighter to suffer from brain injuries and possibly die just so I can be forgotten about a few months after. Nah, I dominated last night, came home to my family unmarked and well, God bless." I thought that was a great
response.
And he
was 100% right. And after I read that response, I think you saw that I retweeted.
Yes.
And basically conceded mea culpa.
Yeah.
You're fucking right.
Well done. Do you think anything will change, or is this just going to be another one of those things where everyone says we need to change, but then the beat goes on?
The beat's probably going to go on to some extent, because who's going to do it? Government doesn't want to get involved. And not only that, the state commissions are a fucking joke. They're political appointees. The doctors even are appointed by their friends who are the people doing the appointing. I mean, an orthopedic doctor is not the best person to be a ringside physician, maybe a neurologist. And by the way, if it's going to be any MD, then take them through a strenuous extra course and neurological symptoms in combat sports. And there's got to be a rule of reason. We can't allow fights that are completely one-sided where the result by the middle of the fight is conclusive to continue when a guy's taking a sustained beating for three minutes around. And we can do better. Look, one thing I'm encouraged by, Ariel, a little bit, is that this week I felt that there was more genuine concern, more genuine upset and conversation, communication between promoters, sitting down at a table actually with Aram and having an intelligent conversation about what we could do better. There was more, and it was appropriate, and it was somewhat, you know, created some optimism, at least to me. But now I sit back a few days removed and say, well, who's going to do it? And we have to do more. We have to do better. There's no question about that.
Curious to get your thoughts on this. Last week, Dana White said that he has confirmed he's brought in someone to lead the way for Zuffa Boxing. We don't know who that is. So he's gonna fix boxing. He's gonna switch things up, things like that. A, does boxing need to be fixed the way in which he's talking about it? And what do you think about him doing this? Do you have any insight into who this person might be?
I have no idea. I think the UFC does a lot of things very well, and they have a centralized authority. They have you know, the marketing and the promotion and the publicity apparatus is unbelievable. And I think Dana is, and you and his organization is capable of getting into this and being a player. And maybe they're going to commit to it with more of an openness to making changes, and time will tell.
Are people in boxing talking about this? Like, okay, here he comes, the guy who changed MMA. Here he comes. Like, are people? Is this a big story in your world right now?
Any time there's a new potential player, people talk about it. But I don't know. Is it a big story? Not yet.
Okay.
You know, it might become one.
Do you think that he could bring the model that he brought to MMA and use it in boxing, or is that not the same sport?
That's not the same sport, but there are, you know, in terms of how you create narratives and tell stories and build to events and have continuity. There are things he could bring to it, I believe.
Okay. Are we going to see Wilder Fury?
I think you will. You know, I it's going to be interesting. I'll tell you what might throw a wrench into it is if the Andy Ruiz rematch with Anthony Joshua happens and Ruiz wins.
Why would that throw a wrench?
It's really because Ruiz fights on the same side of the street with Deontay Wilder, and they're potentially, you know, big, there at that point is a big matchup for a three belt unification, and Tyson Fury's not as needed by Deontay Wilder and PBC. Okay. But if there's really already a contract signed, Ariel, then it's a fait accompli, no?
Right. Is there a contract signed?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not right now actively involved in Deontay's career.
Oh, you're not?
It's a whole other story, my friend, but that's another time.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm sorry for bringing that up. I apologize.
No. It's like I'm sensitive.
Okay.
And my opinion is no less valid.
Okay. Fair enough. Is that new?
I didn't promote his last fight.
Okay. Fair enough. Lou, I appreciate this insight very much. I love talking to you. You're one of the smartest guys in combat sports. So I always appreciate the time. I know you just came back from a trip. So thank you for doing this. And I hope change happens. I love boxing very much. I love combat sports, and everything you said applies to us too. State commission applies to us. All these things apply to us.
You know, so. One last point, Errol. Even if you look at the discussion after there were two stoppages the other night in major fights, Hooker got stopped. The referee stepped in. Javante Davis's opponent, Javante destroyed his opponent.
Yeah.
The referee stepped in, and even the discussion that emanated from those stoppages, I think, had some good things to it. Where fans were talking about the necessity of stopping a fight in time and jumping in time, not erring on the side of safety. You know, look, at this point, there are going to be moments where it's going to be upsetting, but my attitude is going to be always one punch too soon as opposed to one punch too late.
Amen. Thank you, Lou. I appreciate it. All the best to you. Great to talk to you again.
Take care, Ariel. Thank you.
All right. There he is, Lou DiBella. Unfortunately talking under these circumstances, but I think he's one of the smartest minds in combat sports. I wish we had some Lou DiBellas in MMA. I think he's a great guy and certainly knows what he's talking about and is definitely passionate about it as well. All right. One more guest to go. Let's not keep him waiting any longer because he woke up very early to be on this program. I heard he loves talking to us so early that he said, I must wake up at 6 a.m. to be on the show. There he is, the reigning defending UFC middleweight champion, the man, Robert Whittaker. Robert, how are you?
I'm very good, mate. Very good. How are you?
Good morning. Did you have your coffee yet?
Yes, I have.
There it is.
Here, mate.
Well done. Good. Well done, my friend. All right. So we got the big news last week. UFC 243, October 6th in Australia, Marvel Stadium, Melbourne, Australia. Were you worried at any point that they wouldn't be able to figure this out and bring it to Australia and they'd have to do it in Las Vegas?
I wasn't really worried. It's one of those things where I'm just itching to get back in there.
So you didn't really care where it was. You just wanted to fight.
Yeah. It's been a while since my last one, you know, due to unfortunate circumstances. But, I really just want to get in there and get to work.
They have lofty expectations for this card. They're talking 60,000, breaking records of all kinds. Do you feel like it will do that? I mean, there's just pretty much at the top of the bill right now, it's just you two. And I feel like it's big enough. What do you think? Do you feel like this fight is big enough to sell that place out?
I definitely think it's big enough. This is going to be one of the biggest events in combat sports in this part of the world. And Australians and New Zealanders are going to come to this fight. The last fight that I was supposed to be on sold out in a matter of minutes. So, I'm looking forward to trying to set some records for this one.
So I remember asking you this question before the February fight that never was, if you were feeling a little funny, like, you know, because the one two Februaries ago didn't pan out. And then, of course, we know what happened this past February. Does a part of you feel like, oh my gosh, you know, like we have to make it. We cannot pull out of this. We can't have any bad luck. We can't, you know, we have to bubble wrap ourselves. How do you feel about going back to Australia for a third time now?
Yeah, it's just one of those things. I don't think about it. You know, there's a lot of people that came to my last fight and said, I'm not coming to the next one because I'm a jinx or X, Y, and Z. And honestly, it just, what happened, happened. And it wasn't like I got injured and I pulled out due to injury. I went to hospital like that morning. You know, if it was an injury, I'd most likely fight anyway, regardless. You know, it's just the illness that gets me every time, mate.
Does Israel Adesanya annoy you?
Like, in what sense?
Does he get under your skin? Does his words, his rhetoric, his demeanor, does it bother you?
Definitely not. Definitely not. So, you know, to be honest, I'm happy he's doing what he's doing because, one, I find it entertaining, and two, he sells the fight for us, and I'm more than happy to let him do that. And I'm like, yeah, go out there, sell tickets. But, you know, day to day, I have so much on. I have so much on. Like, Jimmy Crute just came down. We're getting in some great training together down here. And as well as, like, our GAP program, I have the Gracie Aboriginal Pathways program that I'm running here. And that's taking off. It's so full on, so busy. The next block is just about to kick off, and I am pumped. As well as, you know, I'm doing my own little podcast as well, which is, you know, it's taking up a lot of time. Grange TV, shameless plug there.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. We've talked about it in the past. So when you saw Israel at the press conference in Las Vegas, when you guys had the stare down, what did you derive from that? What did you take away from it?
It's the same thing. It's the same thing all the time. Every time I get in there, when I'm at these press conferences and when I go for the stare down and the square off, like I'm not playing. I'm not playing. This isn't a game to me. And there's a time for talk and there's a time for action. And he knows I'm not playing. You know, whatever he says and whatever anybody else says, like, he knows I'm not playing. The people that – my fans and the people that know me, they know I don't play. This isn't a game to me, and I'm going in there because this is what I do. This is what I'm good at. It's time to get to work.
Izzy was on the show a couple of weeks ago. I asked him about that face-off. I just want to play you this quick clip and get your response to that. Is that okay?
Sure.
Here he is. What did you make of the stare down? It was intense. What did you draw from that?
It was like staring into a crackhead's eyes. He's very intense. He's very focused. Okay, cool. And I don't know. It is what it is. I'm glad he's not. I'm glad he's keeping that same energy now. He's not trying to fucking shake my hand and all that kind of shit. Because he backtracks. He'll say whatever he wants to say in the interview, and then like, oh, I'm sorry, man. Oh, have I been talking that much? All right. Well, whatever. Do you, Google? But yeah, keep that same energy all the way past the fight.
Okay, so there's a lot to derive from that. First of all, he says he feels like he's looking into a crackhead's eyes. What do you make of that?
I don't know. I've never looked into a crackhead's eyes. I don't have a great point of reference. I don't know what to say. Like, I guess I have crackhead eyes.
Okay, and then what about the keeping the same energy and not being fake and shaking hands? What do you think he means by that? I think he's alluded to this in the past. Was this a conscious effort on your part to not do any of that?
It's one of those things. It's like I shake my opponent's hands out of respect, and I think it's just like a general courtesy to us as humans. I understand, like, yeah, with all my opponents up till now, like, they're just, I've had a lot of respect for them as people. Obviously, I understand that we're going to get into the octagon and we're going to try our best to put each other away, but that's it. That's where it stays. It's in the octagon. That's what we do. We get to work. But, I don't know. He's trying to take deliberate jabs at me, and it's something, like, I don't want to shake his hand.
And so that doesn't annoy you? Crackhead, fake, all these things, fake Aussie. These things don't annoy you? Come on. I know they, deep down, there's not a part of you that's like, who is this guy? How dare he speak about me like this?
Mate, that's the first time I've seen that clip. And, but like, to be honest, it doesn't annoy me because half of everything he says doesn't make sense. You know, he's I don't know who puts together his stuff, but it's not even funny. You know, it's just silly. And like I said, like it takes a lot more than that to get under my skin. I have a team that we take jabs at each other all the time. You know, he's a novice in this game.
Is there a part of you that feels like, you know, okay, I haven't fought since June of 2018. I've had the itch. Like, people have forgotten just how good I am, who the Reaper is, who Bobby Knuckles is. I need to remind you people. Is that part of the motivation here, to remind people just how tough you are, how good you are, that you can shut up people like this, that you can, you know, you are the man at 185. Do you think about that? Does that fire you up?
Yeah, it definitely does, because it's not so much as I think everybody's forgotten me and I want to show them how tough I am. It's more like there's a reason why I'm at the top of the food chain, and you know I'm gonna get out there and I'm gonna remind some people.
Is there a part of you that looks at Israel and says, "You haven't walked a mile in my shoes, like you haven't faced the competition that I've faced. You need to, like, you feel like his head is getting a little too big."
I don't think about him that much. Okay. I don't think how he feels or think like, oh, you should have fought the dudes that I fought. And I am more than happy for him to have gotten the way, gotten as far as he's gotten to the interim belt as he has, and be, you know, facing up against me, because I'm happy for this fight. I love this fight. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to it.
There is something to be said, though, and you just alluded to it moments ago, like every great champion who maybe was a little soft-spoken, when they got that foil, it's only been good business for them as well, right? Like Aldo, McGregor, Aldo made a lot of money, didn't work out as far as the fight is concerned, but it kind of propped up Aldo as well. Silva, Sonnen propped him up. Sometimes it's good if you don't like to go out and do the media and the trash talk. It's good to have a guy who's going to speak and promote the fight, because then that only elevates the stakes. You recognize that, right?
Yeah, definitely. It's not a thing. I do like doing media.
Yeah,
I just don't trash talk. And that's why my whole thing is like, I am so happy if he wants to go out there and sell tickets. Like, he can say whatever he wants. He can do whatever he wants. Like, I am all for it. I am Team Adesanya in that regard, you know. But, we have 60,000 tickets to sell. And, get to work.
And by the way, I'm here to say, for anyone who says that Robert Whittaker does not like to do media, it's 6 a.m. over there, and he has never turned me down. He could very well say, no, I'm not going to wake up. And so I'm here to say that, no, that is false. You do like doing media, or at least you tolerate it for the most part, and we appreciate that very much. He's a very interesting guy as far as his skill set, his build, his length. Will you bring in people who look like him, who fight like him, who are built like him, to try to mimic his style?
If the bodies present themselves, then yes. But otherwise, no. Like, I'm not going to go out on a deliberate effort to try and bring someone in to mimic him. Obviously, there are a lot of problems with trying to get someone to mimic someone who's built and fight so uniquely. So I'm just going out, improving my skill sets every day, working myself to the bone every single day. And honestly, I'm going to come into this next fight the best I have ever been, you know, especially after I've gotten all my health issues under, like, fixed and under control. I've just been training. I've been rehabbing. I've been prehabbing. And, you know, I'm looking really, really good right now.
So you feel 100%? No warning signs, no issues, no nothing?
No, I feel more than 100%. More than 100%. I feel the best I have in years.
Do you get checkups on, you know, your internal system, the bowel, all like do you follow up on that, or is that all clear? You don't have to worry about that anymore.
Post surgery, obviously, I had to get some checkups to see how everything went, but now it's 100%. I am 100% healthy, cleared to fight, cleared for everything, and honestly, you can see the difference in my training. You can see the difference in my energy levels. I'm just much, much better.
Israel has drawn the ire of John Jones. They've gone back and forth as well. It's been somewhat entertaining. But in the midst of that, John has publicly thrown out the offer to help you prepare for Israel Adesanya. Is this a real offer? Is this something that's actually going to happen?
No, I'm sure it would if, you know, he didn't live 20 something hours away. it's just, yeah, you know, there's the whole distance thing. Me and John are cool. Like we've talked a lot, back and forth, and you know, he's a cool guy. He's a straight guy. And, I'm sure I'd get some work with him, but, yeah, he lives in another country.
Okay. So have you talked since this has happened? Like, have you talked recently?
Like I've spoken to John like numerous times over the phone.
Wow.
Obviously over the phone.
About Israel?
No, just about training together and getting together and then maybe getting some training in.
Okay, so he didn't call you up and say, okay, this is how I think you should beat this guy. This is what I would do. This is what none of the game plan stuff really came out.
No. I don't think. He wouldn't just, you don't just drop that on someone.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
What I mean? My own coaches and everything for that.
Is there any part of you that is concerned that at some point in the build up to this fight, because we've talked about, you know, fake Aussie and all this stuff, like it will go to an uncomfortable place? Are you worried about that? That it will just sort of cross the line as far as pre fight promotion is concerned?
Nah. Like you saw the press conference. It didn't get out of hand there either.
Yeah.
He's trying to sell the fight, but I don't think he's going to do anything stupid.
Okay. All right. And are you prepared for the attention? I mean, you know, there's a lot of attention coming your way. This is going to be a big deal. I was talking to a journalist last week, Adam Curley, who was telling me about how this stacks up and how much attention you're getting now. Like come October, come late September, everyone's going to be hounding you. Everyone's going to be knocking on your door to talk to you, to make you do things. Are you prepared for all of this? Are you almost like excited for this because it's been so long?
You know what the only thing is, honestly, that I feel is that it feels a little sour to me because I feel like it's deja vu. I did all this before and I didn't get to fight, and that left a sour, bitter taste in my mouth. And it feels like I'm doing this all again, and it feels funny. Feels funny.
That's interesting.
I really want to get in there, and I want to get to work. I want to fight. You know, a lot of people think that I don't want to fight. And that's ridiculous. I like to make money, and I also like to fight. Like it's my job, it's my sport, it's what I do. And like I find it absolutely astounding that people can think I don't want to do this.
That is amazing. So you haven't fought since June of 2018. Has that been hard money wise? Because you're not getting paid if you're not getting, you know, getting fights. You're not getting in there.
Yeah, you know, fortunately for me, like I do have great business partners around me, and you know, we are, I don't know, days away from signing a new lease for a second gym out this way. And you know, obviously I can't talk about the details just yet, but I'm pretty clever when it comes to spending my money. I don't make silly purchases. I don't have an expensive lifestyle. I have a great team around me that help me keep me in check and keep me well supported.
I know we're about 2 months away, but have you already envisioned how you're going to beat Israel Adesanya? Does one method keep creeping up into your thoughts?
Well before, you know, this point now, I've been envisioning beating him. As soon as he beat Gastelum, all my thoughts were like in a training sense and in a fighting sense were on him. Like every day, it's about formulating plans on beating him and trying to strengthen those skill sets that I'm going to utilize to capitalize on the holes that I saw that he has. And I've seen me beating him in my head 100 times.
I can't wait for it.
That's all of my.
Say it again. What was that?
But it's all in my head. You know, you still got to get out there and do it.
Of course. October 6th, it shall be done. I am looking forward to it. Adesanya Whitaker, one of the biggest fights in the history of this game, 60,000 Marvel Stadium. It's going to be insane. Good luck to you, my friend. I hope you have a safe and healthy and a positive training camp, and perhaps we'll check in with you later on. But again, sincerely, as I've said to you privately, I'm almost embarrassed when I asked you to come on this early, but you're a big deal, my man. So I really wanted you on after the announcement, and I really appreciate you waking up early to do the show.
Don't sweat it. Honestly, I really appreciate you, having me on. And yeah, you know, I always enjoy it. It's kind of why I make the effort.
All right. Thank you, Robert. All the best to you.
All the best to you. See ya.
There he is. Robert Whittaker, UFC 243. Will Alex Volkanovski be on that card? We shall find out. That's going on as we speak, those talks. Volkanovski, Whittaker, will it be the co-main event? Can they convince Max Holloway? Did I say Whittaker? No. Volkanovski, Holloway. Can they convince Holloway to turn around, essentially go right back into a training camp? It would be gigantic. It would be insane. And what's going on with Dan Hooker and Ally Quinta? What's going on there? Will they add that fight to the card? All I know is that Whitaker Adesanya is a done deal October 5th here in the States, October 6th in Melbourne, Australia. And I just found out I'll be there as well. So that'll be a lot of fun. But for now, we shall say goodbye. We have taken up way too much time. It's been a fun day, a very eclectic day. In the like last hour and a half, we went from Nick Lentz to Freddie Prinze Jr. to Chris Cyborg to Lou DiBella to Robert Whitaker. I mean, where else? Where else? Where else than this show? Get off me. Thank you, Edmonton. It was great. I really enjoyed being there. Congrats to all the winners on Saturday night. I kind of needed those papers. Oh, here it is. Thank you to all our guests today. Thanks to all our viewers. I love you all very much. Thank you to Eric Hoke. Great story. Appreciate his time. Congratulations on the big win. How about Jeff Neal? Congratulations to him. Thank you very much to Hakeem Daoudou. Mean Hakeem. Smile. You're a winner. Thank you very much to Jillian Robertson. She smiles a lot. Thank you very much to Nick Lentz. That was deep. Thank you to the great Freddie Prinze Jr. Amazing stuff. I could listen to those stories all day. Thank you very much to Chris Cyborg. Good luck to her. Thank you very much to Lou DiBella. And thank you very much and best of luck to the great Robert Whittaker. In case you missed anything, check it out. YouTube, Twitter, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, all those places and more. Back next week, same time and place. Till they say peace. I'm out of here.